the legal aid board, and they are over here. The legal aid board is here, and you have the committees of correctional services and of South African police services with us. So we're all here. Last week, ladies and gentlemen, we started our interaction around the overcrowding. And a further lecture that would be for the committee or for Parliament to understand, and this is what we're hoping you're going to give us. Some sort of a briefing on the from the police side, specifically the investigation. You'll recall that some of us feel that you arrest to investigate instead of investigating and then arresting. Delays in the court procedures. Prosecutors not ready. People on recess. All those type of things, because all that contributes to the overcrowding and the inhumane facilities that we have in South Africa. We'd also want somebody to talk to us around the bail, specifically on why the police, or what the police can do. We know that they have been, or they have the right to grant bail. Where I come from, I can tell you that there's people sitting in there and the police don't do it because it's too late and there's nobody that is senior enough to do it. Most of the police stations that I visit there, it's certainly not happening. And then finally, somebody to talk to us about the progress on the remand detention centers. Are these going to be separate from the current correctional facilities? Are you going to refurbish the current one? You'd recall that we're not sure anymore how many of these remand detention centers or our ability to have cases within our facilities, how many of them are actually up and running. We get reports that there are 11, then we get reports that there's only one that is working, and all those types of things. Somebody to explain that to us. And then we'll open it up for the normal rigorous discussion and debate. Having said that, we'll hand over to, I would imagine you'll do a combined briefing, or are you going to do separate, a combined briefing? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair, and honourable members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be again with you. As normally, we've tried to prepare a joint presentation from justice, prosecuting authority, correctional services and police aside. But I've brought with me the members from both departments that can assist you with any of the questions that you've raised, if we've not covered enough in the presentation, but to also deal with responses from committee members. From DCS side, we've got Mr. Matetwa and Mr. Dalmont and Mr. Mbambu. From SAP side, we've got Major General Vinesh Munu, from the detectives in particular, who's been dealing with, who can deal with a lot of the aspects that you've mentioned. Brigadier Linda and then Colonel Nair. From Legal Aid South Africa side, we've got Mr. Patrick Windermark here. So, Chair, with those few introductions, if I can just give an indication. We'll focus on, firstly, the delays in the investigations and court proceedings, some of the challenges, the factors that play a role, some of the interventions that we've already started to put in place to help address the remand detention population, and the delays in the investigation. Then we'll be dealing with the bail aspects in particular. And then, lastly, we'll deal with the refurbishment of a dedicated remand detention. Now, if I can just shortly just give an indication, if you look at the awaiting trial numbers, then we'll see that from 1995 we had a spike up till 2000, and from there on, it's basically a stabilized situation. So, although there's a small fluctuation find that the numbers remain around about 50,000. So that's about as far as we could basically reduce it unless we go and really have drastic steps, etc. If we look at the numbers that have been in detention specifically for 2009 and for the first and second quarters of 2010, then we see in actual fact that there has been a slight decrease from 48,000 to 47,400, which is a small decrease, but during 2010 we've already seen that there is some stabilization, and obviously there is the cyclical changes. So we're not going to deal much in terms of statistics, as you've also requested last time, but we'll just here and there have some indications. Now, some of the challenges that we had was previously, before we had the criminal justice system review and the implementation of the 7-point plan, was a lack of strategic alignment between the various departments. We also had capacity issues and alignment across the criminal justice system, specifically equipping and staffing of the police forensic services were major challenges. There was a major shortage of detectives as a critical reason in finalization of investigations, a backlog in detective training and experience levels. There's a lot of focus in the last 2 or 3 years on major international events, and although that's very good for our country and for the image of South Africa, it detracts from normal investigations because huge numbers of police have to be sent to help to deal with those sort of events. We had vacancies in the prosecuting authority, shortage of judicial officers and other role players in the system, private attorneys in terms of overbooking and requesting postponements, etc., and then even cooperation by witnesses during investigation and trial phases was challenges. Other aspects that in many of our cases we had multiple numbers of co-accused, all accused that are linked with other crimes that are under investigation, and requests for separation of trials. All those have an impact in delaying some of the finalization of the matters. Failures of witnesses to appear in court, leading to various remands for that case. Requests for remands by either the prosecutors or the defense lawyers. Failure of the accused to appear in court. Withdrawal or changing of legal representation. One of the major problems is securing dates in the High Court as a result of very full roles, multiple witnesses, and loss of records. Now, we've dealt with all of those aspects through the implementation of a 7-point plan that follows the criminal justice system, and we've started to put in measures to help deal with those, and I'll try and focus on some of those. Specifically, in terms of reducing case backlogs, etc., we've, as indicated last time, established 55 backlog courts in the regional courts and a number of them now in the district courts. And we specifically started to focus on all those cases where remand detainees have been in detention for longer than 2 years. In this regard, we've asked for the profiling of all of those cases from the prosecuting authority side. We started to interact with the directors of public prosecution, bringing those cases forward, looking at the reasons why they are being delayed, and trying to prioritize them with the assistance of legal aid as well as the other role players involved in. We've also appointed more detectives and improved training and skilling in particular, and we've started to establish more dedicated courts in certain areas. Specifically, the serious commercial crime courts have made a big dent in both numbers types of cases. But here in the Western Cape, for example, we're now looking at environmental courts to deal with abalone and those sort of things which are creating big pressure points, as well as some of the environmental type of aspects that needs to be dealt with. Case flow management has been a very big focus area from the department and the role player side. In this regard, what we've done is we established in every province a case flow management coordinating mechanism. In some provinces, it's led by the judge president. In other provinces, it's led by the regional head of justice or some of the other role players that are senior managers in terms of dealing with these things. The various regional court presidents and chief magistrates are very specifically invited to those case flow management meetings, and they help deal with any blockages that arise and that require intervention at that level. Then at a lower level, we've also said where the cases are heard at a lower level, the magistrates must have monthly meetings with the role players and try and sort out any issues there. So case flow management and coordinating mechanisms in that regard has been a very important tool to help deal with some of these long delays and trying to finalize the cases. We've also developed a bail protocol, and this protocol was signed by all the ministers, and it has been implemented and it's been monitored on a monthly basis. Part of that is also dealing with bail management, because the law is quite clear in terms of it. But we find that it's not the legislation that's the issue, it's how it's been implemented at the local level. We find that specifically in some instances, the police and prosecutors don't give all the information to the court, etc. And as a result of that, bail is not dealt with properly. So what we're trying to do is we've developed directives from prosecuting authority side, as well as from the police, to help deal with training, etc., to make sure that those things happen. Further interventions that we've dealt with is to make sure that there's readiness in terms of the dockets from the police's side, and this is now part of the police strategic and annual performance plan. It's also part of the JCP's delivery agreement that was signed last Sunday by the Minister of Justice. And in this regard, what we've done from police's side is we appointed specifically detective court case officers in various of the big centres throughout the country to ensure that they can coordinate the activities in terms of the dockets at those courts and liaise with the prosecutors. We've also established pre-trial offender assessments with regard to the possibility of police of bail by the police. And in this regard, what is happening is we're trying to have a pre-trial screening of the cases. So before the case comes to court, the police is already looking at assessing those offenders, trying to trace their whereabouts in terms of home addresses, the work addresses, making sure that that information is then being able to given through to the prosecutors and to the courts, so that when those people do appear, that they are then enabled to deal with those matters in a proper way. We've entered into a forensic services protocol between the police and prosecutors to ensure that what's happening there, right from the taking of a sample till the analysis, is fixed up and dealt with. So all of this is to make sure that the cases are being dealt with as quickly as possible and the investigation is as thoroughly as possible. From prosecuting side, we've tried to ensure that not only that the dockets are ready, but also that the case is trial ready. And in this regard, we've established a screening protocol that's in place here in the Western Cape and in some of the other provinces where we're now starting to deal with it. And this makes sure that the police and the prosecutors screen that case and make sure that everything that is required for the case to be tried is in place, so that there's no further delays required. We've also established and developed case flow management guidelines, and there's a new version that's currently being printed for distribution. Legal aid and the prosecutors have entered into a protocol to limit the disputes and improve coordination between the role players, and the regional court presidents have dealt with the trial phase through a court protocol. In terms of the Chief Justice, he's now become involved in the process of case flow management, particularly not only of the High Court but also of the lower court. He's appointed one of the Constitutional Court judges to chair a committee that deals with delays in cases and backlogs. And in this regard, there is monthly meetings now from JCP's DG side with the judiciary. So we hope that all of that will be positive interventions to help ensure that the whole process from investigation through prosecution to the court stage are expedited. We've gone further in this regard, and we've given additional capacity. We've given more forensic analysts, we've given more detectives, prosecutors, magistrates, and legal aid representatives. But we've gone further than that, and we've established specific strategic policy frameworks, specifically regarding things like restorative justice, alternative dispute solution mechanisms, diversion, and mediation. And this has been implemented countrywide. This week, there will be before the JCPS DGs a framework for restorative justice in particular, to ensure that that becomes a mainstay pillar in which the courts can deal with some of these matters. We also, as we indicated last time, promoting the improved use of admission of guilt by prosecutors as well as by the police. And specifically, we've got monthly monitoring meetings by an intersectoral committee on child justice, and through that we've really managed to stabilize and reduce the numbers of children in prisons. As I've indicated, capacity by the various role players have been specifically tackled, and in this regard, the detectives have grown by more than 22% in the past year. In addition, we have at the moment 2,153 new recruits that will bolster the detective capacity, and they are currently undergoing basic training. In addition, we've also increased the number of visible policing members so that we can help decrease crime in general throughout the country. Prosecutors, at least 83 have been appointed as part of a permanent staff, but in terms of each of the 55 backlog courts, we've got additional staff from both prosecutors, magistrate, as well as legal aid to help deal with those. Legal Aid South Africa has increased their posts, and they'll be dealing with that a little bit later, but we've also appointed more judges and magistrates. At the moment, there's at least 27 magistrates that are undergoing training at Justice College as part of their pre-screening process, and after that, they will be appointed permanently. We've also looked at, in terms of the police, to look at family violence, child protection and sexual offences units. These were at some point in time disbanded, but they have now been reintroduced to specifically look at speeding up those cases that deal with those vulnerable groups of family, violence, children and sexual offences. 176 units have been established in all of the 9 provinces. Chair, in terms of investigations, in this regard, the Detective Services Division has implemented a specific strategic plan which focuses on in the inspections throughout the country to ensure there's quality of investigations. Sorry, I'm not sure what has happened there. In terms of this, they go throughout the country, they pay visits to all the police stations, they look at the detective units, and they ensure that there's quality of investigations, and that the matters that have been outstanding for some time are speeded up in terms of investigation. They also not only do these visits, but they also have quarterly audits of the cases that are outstanding on the court rolls to identify those stations where there are interventions required and that need to be inspected. They then do targeted interventions at those stations and make sure that when they do visit those stations and they've dealt with the matters there, that they give one-on-one type of service in-service training to the detective commanders at those stations as well as to the investigation officers, and they provide further guidance in terms of notes and one-on-one type of training on the finalization of the court cases there. So I think from the police side, they've really tried to say that it's not business as usual. There's a requirement to do more, and I think this type of intervention shows that they are really trying to target that. In terms of training, the training of detectives is now a priority of police, and specifically the human resources strategic plan and management plan has that as a very focused area. They've also introduced mentorship programs where inexperienced detectives are placed with experienced detectives so that they can guide and mentor them and make sure that best practices are through that way shared. In order to deal with the fact that we have court cases that are ready for the courts, the Detective Services have in particular established a new performance measurement indicator, which is court-ready cases. So that is something that's now part of their strategic plan. It's monitored specifically, and it's looked at how many cases are court-ready within a specific period of time. This will ensure that detectives can deal with these matters speedily, and it's not a question of just arresting. It's a question of they need to make sure that the investigations are properly dealt with. So hopefully this will undo that culture that you've mentioned previously that they investigate to arrest. So this will help turn that around and deal with it in an improved way. The integrated coordination between the prosecutors and police make sure that the detective court case officers that have been placed at the court can help rehave and make sure that the inquiries that the prosecutors raise are dealt with speedily. We've also looked at the record of previous convictions, the so-called SAP 69s, and in this regard we found that many cases this has been delayed, so we've now put in measurement tools to ensure that there's a turnaround time that's speedier than in the past. Fingerprints are forwarded to the criminal record centers for processing within 72 hours after being obtained, and those records must then be produced within 30 days. It's captured on the computer system and it can be printed out at the court close by where the case is being dealt with. So in this regard, station commanders and commanders of the criminal record centers are now being held responsible where the targets are not being achieved in this regard. Once again, to speed up the processes. If we look at bail in particular, then I think one of the first things that we need to again stress is that the discretion of granting bail is in the hands of an independent presiding official. This is, however, influenced by a range of factors, and this can be from the flight risk to the economic, socioeconomic circumstances, affordability, etc. One of the challenges that we've had is the fact that legislation prescribes that there's a two-stage bail process that needs to be followed by the presiding officers, and we've now started training to make sure that they deal with that and deal with it in a proper way. From our side, we're trying to ensure that through policy directives to the police as well as to the prosecutors, they are guided to bring all the required factors before the court so that the court can make a proper decision. What we've also tried to do is to combat the situation where people are sitting in correctional facilities with unaffordable bail. And in this regard, we've tried to use all the elements in the Criminal Procedure Act to deal with it in a positive way. If I can just very shortly show some statistics in this regard. For 2009, we've had 23,000 applications in terms of Section 63, where the head of the prisons brought those cases back to the courts and said, please re-look at these. And we've had 66% of those that were actually approved by the court after being brought back to them. This year, from April to September, we've already had 11,000, and of that, 67% of them have been approved, so that those people have been allowed to go out on less bail than previously, or even on conditions or on warning. So I think this is a positive aspect, once again, that is leading to ensuring that there's less remand detention people. If we look at this slide in terms of the length of detention of remand detainees, I want to indicate that basically if we look at this slide, then we see that 66% of the awaiting trial prisoners are actually detained less than 6 months. So 66% are less than 6 months. 77% of the people are there for less than 9 months, 82% less than 12 months, which leaves about 15% that's there for longer than 12 months. Now, if we look at where can we deal with issues, then specifically the percentage where we can really make an impact on are those that are there for very long periods of time. And I think this is where we're trying to say that all those cases longer than 2 years, let's investigate them, let's look at how we can prioritize them, and see how we can speed up. The problem areas where we don't have much control over is those that are there for 1 to 3 months type of things. Because in those times, there's a lot of movement in and out of prison. I think we need to realize when we say we've got 50,000 or 47,000 or whatever number of awaiting trial prisoners, they are not constant. It's not the same people that are there from January that are there again in December, because they fluctuate. Those people come in and come out on a basic 2 month cycle. We find that there's changes in terms. The only ones that remain there are the ones that are there for a longer period of time. So from our side, what we've been trying to do to say is that we are from the criminal justice review side engaging with correctional services to analyze these statistics specifically, but also to look at interventions where we can deal with those in conjunction with the prosecuting authority and the police to ensure that we focus on those areas. I think one of the aspects that we have a challenge with at this point in time is the management information from correctional services in terms of the people that are in these facilities. In this regard, the IT systems is still problematic. We don't have full data integrity, and they are working on it, but it is presenting us with a challenge. Because if we say, for example, give us a list of all those people that are there longer than 3 years, they actually can't give it immediately. They have to go and check and deal with it, and it takes time. And by the time we get it, that list is outdated. So when we give it to the prosecutors to investigate, there's a challenge. So we're trying to fix that up and make sure that we get that information and basically in a lifetime type of thing. So, Chair, I think from my side, I want to indicate that with regard to the remand detention facilities, the analysis in this regard has been done. You've indicated earlier on that there's not certainty of exactly how many there are. From our side, the information that we have is that they are working on 11 facilities. They are busy dealing with upgrading of those, but fortunately I have got correctional services officials here that will give more detail. What has been happening is that they've looked specifically at upgrading 3 for male and 2 for female correctional centres, specifically in the past financial year. They are looking at Pretoria local, Johannesburg medium and Potchefstroom for upgrading. The cost is quite significant, and they are looking at options and feasibility in this regard, as well as awaiting some funds from National Treasury. I think the project timelines, when these will be ready, is something that they are negotiating with Public Works, but Chair, I think they will be able to give more detail in terms of this. In conclusion, I can perhaps just state that from the JCPS cluster side, we've entered into an agreement, a delivery agreement with the President, and that delivery agreement focuses on all these areas that we've mentioned, the investigation side, the speeding up of the criminal justice system, bail aspects, it deals with remand detention. We, for example, had all of these elements with specific activities for the year ahead placed in that delivery agreement, so that it's not just word, it's part of an agreement by the various ministers that have signed this and by the department. From our side, we are really focusing on ensuring that there's less delays in investigations, that there's speedier trials and prosecuting processes. We're focusing specifically on the remand detention population. We've worked with correctional services to help develop their white paper on remand detention, as well as the amendments to their correctional services legislation. And hopefully this will in the long term ensure a positive impact on reducing the number of remand detention, as well as the length of incarceration pending the finalization of matters. From our side, we also, however, wish to stress that there is a constitutional obligation to, on the one hand, ensure the safety of the community, whilst on the other hand, balancing the rights of remand detainees. Chair, thank you very much. I will ask my colleague, Mr. Hoenemark, to then just deal with the legal aid presentation.
Good morning, Chair and members of the Honourable Committee. Thank you for this opportunity. I think Mr. Durant has quite well dealt with a lot of the issues and covering from a legal aid perspective. So I will skip through some of my slides and then deal with a few issues I think that came up last week and be able to respond on some of those issues from the solution for the committee's benefit. Obviously, I think the issue of delays in court proceedings is quite a complex issue and is a result of a multitude of factors that goes across the board. And the more you look and investigate into some matters that have had lengthy delays, you will see that a lot of the delays can be present all in one case. And so a couple of things that we've looked at when we've investigated issues that's come to our attention, specifically Mr. Durant mentioned some of the cases that's longer than 2 years. In some instances, we've had a few cases that have run longer than 5 years. So we've specifically gone and looked and to try and understand what are these factors that impact on these delays to see where they can be addressed. And I think that's what the CJS review was also involved in, and that's where a lot of the protocols that Mr. Durant mentioned have come from, is to then exactly look at these issues and understand them and to be able to address them as best as possible within the system. But that's also not always possible, and that's why I said it's quite a complex issue. The issue of further investigations, quality of investigations, and I think that has been dealt with adequately by Mr. Durant. Missing dockets and charge sheets, I think those are the issues in terms of how do we improve the system in terms of docket management and management of court documents by making use of electronic mechanisms. But there we also got to understand it's resource intensive, it's also labour intensive to sit and scan and index documents on an ongoing basis. And I think there are financial implications in terms of going to such a system that have to be understood before you can say that that will be the solution to everything at the end. I think everything has its pros and cons. Witnesses not arriving or being available at court, accused not arriving from prison, or accused out on bail not arriving. So you can have any one of these factors. Accused not accessible or arriving for consultations with their legal representative. Sometimes you can go out to a prison to be able to go and consult. Sometimes you can't find your clients because they're not able to locate within the prison, might have gone off to another court case. Some instances where you've got clients that are out on bail, you set a date and time for consultations with them, don't arrive for them. So you have various challenges linking to that. Accused changing legal representatives for various reasons, and I think there's a lot of those factors. There's conflict of interest between the co-accused. So sometimes you have one representative on representing two, three or four accused, but somewhere along the line a clash happens between the accused versions where they start implicating each other, and the same practitioner cannot continue representing all of them. In fact, you then have to replace that representative with as many representatives as are required by those accused, depending on what their clashes are, and then they've got to go read themselves into the court record. You've got to have the court record transcribed, so you do have those kind of issues. Conflicting instructions to the legal representative, which then ethically obliges the legal representative, where substantial, to withdraw from the case so that a new representative can be appointed. Dismissal of legal representative, that also happens where there's a dissatisfaction or where the client is not satisfied what's been put. And unfortunately, legal practitioners must run the case in terms of what their expertise does. Sometimes the clients want something different, which is contrary to that. And that becomes then difficult to manage. Then also an inability to pay private practitioner fees. What you find is at late stages, practitioners then withdraw, and we get called on from a legal aid perspective, then to get involved in a part-time trial where this has happened, or the trial's on the day and that practitioner's withdrawn and we've got to try and then find a legal representative in very, very short notice to be able to take over, prepare the trial, and to ensure no prejudice to the client in terms of trial preparation. Then obviously you have a lot of the absence of court staff, officials, presiding officers, prosecutors, legal representatives. Specifically in longer running cases you'll find there could be illnesses and those. So those in themselves are isolated, very ad hoc and difficult to be able to manage. You can't help it if a legal practitioner is ill. And then one of the major issues I found in more serious matters that require quite a number of trial days have been specifically that there weren't running roles that were in place. So what you'd find is a trial will be set out for one day, it needs 10 days, and you can see it from up front from the docket, it needs 10 days, but they do the 10 days, one now, one another month later, one 3 months later, and they spread it then over a period of time, which then doesn't help the speed of the trial, and then also results in delays in the spread of the trial over a period of time. So those are the kinds of things you find when you start looking at these matters, where there have been lengthy delays in terms of the finalisation of the issue. I'm not going to deal specifically with further investigations. Obviously, from our perspective, we find that the vast majority of trials lasts less than 5 days, but that's then on average to looking at district court matters, regional courts, and high court matters. Obviously, a high court takes longer. But a high proportion of our postponements initially linked to further investigations and those kinds of issues, and that's where the protocols have been put into place to be able to address those concerns from our perspective, so that we can look as role players and within the justice cluster how we can address all these various issues that have been causing the delays. And obviously for us then what happens is with that we're using resources to do postponements instead of running trials. And so that's obviously, and I think that's cross-cutting in terms of the cluster. For us in terms of cases, about 65% of our cases we find are withdrawn prior to trial. But what happens is, of course, that it's been happening at a very late stage. So what you have is all your pre-trial preparations and the consultations have taken place, and then the matter gets withdrawn. And that's where the protocol in regard to the case docket review system, to ensure that no matters are placed on a trial roll unless they are trial ready, is then critical in addressing those kinds of issues from our perspective. Therefore, you can use your resources more effectively in preparing for those cases that are trial ready, and in so doing, they obviously reduce any delays in the running of the trial. And all these, though, have been dealt with as part of the 7-point plan in terms of the criminal justice system review, and so therefore, solutions have been implemented to try and address and move those on. Case finalization times, I think Mr. Durant dealt with it from an overall perspective. Obviously from us, we set targets in terms of our finalization of cases, and we monitor them on an ongoing basis. In fact, we submit the quarterly reports through to the executive authority. What we have at quarter two of this financial year, 19% of our district court cases were not finalized in the targeted 6-month period. 24% of regional court cases were not finalized in the target of 9 months. And then 42% of our high court cases were not finalized in 12 months in this quarter. That's quite a jump from what it was at about 25%. But having a look at that, that mostly was linked to appeals and the resulting delays as a result of problems of obtaining court records, and that to be able to then draft the appeal and deal with the appeal in court. So that's overall, but once again, these are monitored on an ongoing basis. And obviously the protocols have that have been put into place to try and reduce these times overall. I'm not going to necessarily deal with bail protocol. I think Mr. Durant has dealt with it adequately. Obviously, from our perspective, we're also very concerned about it. And one of the issues in terms of our practitioners, I think this might have been dealt with at the previous presentation, was where we see there's an issue that we can deal with in terms of one case that can impact across the board for all clients. We try and bring such impact litigation. Specifically, we were having problems initially with the implementation of a two-stage approach to bail, specifically in terms of our clients who were not able to afford bail, where bail amounts were being set. And what you do find at stages is, if you have a release of anyone that has bail below R1,000, the next step is magistrates will set bail at R1,500. Therefore, you get the creep in terms of the bail that has been set, and you're not considering the actual circumstances of the accused that is before you. Because by saying, I accept that you should get bail and I'm setting a bail amount for you, the court has accepted this person is entitled to bail, they will return and come and stand their trial. What you're doing is prejudicing poor people that are not able to afford monetary bail. And that's why our insistence that you've got to look at the issue of affordability at the second stage of the trial. And that's why when that wasn't happening, we brought this case, specifically in the Eastern Cape, to then get clarity as to the two-stage approach, as to its interpretation, so that we could inform our practitioners this is the way it must happen, and to get a decided case out of the High Court, which we then duly did in this case. And so this is how we've then also gone to our practitioners and said they must ensure that this two-stage is implemented. If it's not implemented, we want to know from a management perspective, because those matters then we can take on appeal, we can deal with it on an issue, and deal with it then on a broader basis across the cluster. So I think those are the critical issues. I think for me, I'll be moving in terms of my formal presentation. I think there were some issues that came up that were concerns at last week's meeting, which I think are critical for us to deal with. And I think Peter mentioned the issues of staffing. Obviously for us, from a legal aid perspective, we run, the majority of our work is done by our salaried legal practitioners, about 93% of that work. And then the other 6 or 7% is by private practitioners that we pay on a case-by-case basis, which we call G-Care. And then we also have some cooperation partners where, in certain areas where we find it's not viable to open a full office or a satellite office, that will appoint a practitioner on a retainer basis to do any of the cases emanating from that area, pay them a retainer, and it makes it, from that perspective, it's sustainable for them then to open an office or have a permanent practitioner servicing those courts, and therefore that they can then do those cases, and then we pay them then a monthly retainer to be able to do that. So that's the model we use overall to try and cover, and we have 100% coverage of all our courts, whether with our salary practitioners, duty care practitioners, or those cooperation partners. What you do have in terms of the staffing, the district court that we have, from a staffing perspective, 80% coverage. So what it means is you can't cover the courts on every single day of the week in the district courts because our staffing is not sufficient to cover each court every day of the week. So we have about 80% coverage in terms of the number of court days. Regional court, we have 100% coverage of the number of court days. But there we have about 1.25 practitioners per regional court. The 0.25 is really so that each of our practitioners can get one day off in a week for the consultations and the preparations that they are required. So obviously the necessary preparations can happen for their cases that are going ahead in the following week. So that they've got time to be able to do those consultations and preparations, specifically given the time off. In terms of the issues are from a quality monitoring perspective, I think there were some concerns mentioned here. What has got to be understood is we have a comprehensive quality monitoring mechanism where we do file audits on each of the files of each of the legal practitioners. We also then do a court observation on each of the practitioners. That's done at each of the justice centres by the management team that we have in place. We've also established an independent quality audit unit, a legal quality audit unit that falls under our internal audit department that separately reports directly to our board, where they specifically go out as well and they check the quality reviews. They bring quarterly reports to the board in terms of the issues that they are checking, in terms of the quality of the legal representation, ensuring that there's proper preparation, that there has been research done in the cases that require the search, so that all the evidence you require for proper, competent legal representation is present, and then also observing the legal practitioners in court to observe that. So we've done that as a specific intervention. It's the most comprehensive program. I don't even think the private legal profession, whom we consulted when we were busy developing these documents over a period of time, don't have such a quality monitoring mechanism in place as for the overall profession. We also then have quality improvement measures, which we link to it. So there's a lot of measures we also look at. How do we improve the quality? In terms of, we have peer reviews. So peers review each other like you would in terms of doctors. How you dealt with the case, how would they have dealt with it differently in terms of strategy? We have a whole legal training program, which falls under my section, that's legal development. So we look at the issues from an individual development plan perspective of our employees. We do skills audits to go and determine where are the issues that we feel that they need to have as a legal practitioner, what competencies they have, where we feel there is a skills gap. We then bring training programs into place, we develop them, and we roll out the training programs across the board to all our practitioners in terms of attending. And those statistics are specifically mentioned in our annual report, but I won't go into that in detail. So we have specific programs to look at how we can address those issues. Obviously, in terms of the right to a fair trial, I think we've also got to understand the context of a right to a fair trial. It doesn't necessarily mean at the end of the whole trial process that you'll necessarily be found not guilty. If you've run through, there's been a proper investigation, a proper prosecution, you've heard a valid defense, it may be so that you are then found guilty by a competent court, and that is something I think we have to accept as part of the process. What you do have is also then an entitlement, if you're not satisfied with that, then to apply for leave to appeal against your conviction and or your sentence. We have policies in place that says our practitioners must, in writing, request the client whether they want to apply for leave to appeal. And even if the leave to appeal is refused by the original presiding officer, without issue linking to the question of merit, to then also petition the judge president of the High Court for leave to appeal if the client elects. So that's the client's election. We require the client to make that election in writing or by using fingerprints, but it's got to be fully and properly explained to them. That's part of the requirement. We don't allow a file to be closed doors off unless we've got evidence that those rights have been explained to the client and that where he required or she required the application for leave to appeal or the petition for leave, that that has been done. No file, whether it's from a private practitioner that we agree from a duty care basis or in-house practitioner, are entitled to close file without that having been done. So we have that very specifically in place to deal with it. And then obviously if they get leave on either of those two legs, we will also assist them with an appeal. Any assistance thereafter, because of limited resources, is then where we must be satisfied that there are merits to then proceed further to go to the Supreme Court of Appeal to seek leave to appeal. And we will do that in instances where we are satisfied on a merit report that there is justification in going further than those two legs of the application for leave to appeal. That's in line with the Mshinga judgment out from the Constitutional Court, and so we've aligned our policy in terms of that to the Mshinga judgment from the Constitutional Court. I think also in terms of data and the database, I think Mr. Grant correctly points out, we're busy with two, we've dealt with two matters in the Constitutional Court. The one where certain provisions in terms of the Dangerous Weapons Act that was still applicable in the former Transkei, where there were certain minimum sentences that were only applicable in the former Transkei area, where persons who even maybe used in a chair in an assault had a minimum sentence of 2 years, had to go to direct imprisonment. We brought a case to the Constitutional Court exactly on those facts, saying it's unconstitutional that in that area of South Africa, 15, 16 years on, we have persons facing minimum sentences that no one else faces in the rest of the country, that had been conceded and found to be unconstitutional. We're now in the process there of trying to identify who have been convicted in terms of that act so we can then deal with setting aside their sentence, their conviction and sentence in terms of that act. But it's very difficult then to find those numbers from the database in terms of correctional services, and or even with the assistance of the MPA, because the responsibility was placed on the MPA in this document, to then go and find that information. The second instance where we also have is children, where the Minimum Sentences Act was also found unconstitutional insofar as it was applicable to children between the ages of 16 and 18. So there are certain children as well that while we are sitting that have got minimum sentences that was imposed on them, that we have now got to try and assist to try and then take their matters either on review or appeal. And once again, the database becomes the challenge for us overall in trying to locate where those children are so that we can render the necessary assistance to them. I think also one of the issues in terms of the quality of legal representation, one of the things that we measure on is the level of unrepresented accused. And that for us comes through in what we call the automatic reviews. Now, an automatic review happens where an accused is legally unrepresented, but a magistrate, I think, of less than 6 years' experience sentences them to more than 3 months direct imprisonment, or with more than 6 years' experience sentences them to more than 6 months direct imprisonment. And over the period that we've monitored them, and it's page 20 of our annual report, item 20 on it there, we've shown that from when we initially started monitoring it, these were about 30,000 automatic reviews per annum. In the last financial year, the 31st of March, it's now decreased to 9,537. But we have ongoing programs in terms of visiting prisons, and we're busy now implementing a survey in prisons both of awaiting child detainees and also sentenced detainees who didn't have legal representation from us to understand why. Because it's an issue for us in terms of it. We're an organization that has been performing over the years. We need to also understand why persons that could make use of our representation and face substantial injustice chose to go through unrepresented. So we're looking at those surveys to then understand that, to see how we can address that as an issue from a legal aid board perspective. I think, Chair, that just covers, I think, the issues that from last week and this week, and thanks for the extra time to be able to deal with those.
Thank you very much. Lessons learned from last week were that, you know, when we engaged, there were probably just one or two people from your side that responded. So what I'm suggesting today is that we deal with the delays in investigation, not with that. Finish the delays of investigation, deal with the proceedings of court and affordable. In that way, you have everybody that's here answer for him or herself. Last week that didn't happen. And I think that it was, we were poorer for that. So I'm going to allow for any comments, questions that deal specifically with delays around investigations only. Only delays around investigations. When we feel that we're happy with that, we'll move on to the next one. So just on delays around investigations, and hopefully our colleague from SAPS will be able to answer those questions for us. I note Ms. Nguyenia and then Ms. Kola Barnard. Baba Ndlovu and then Chairperson Cindy is sitting far away. Cindy, and then it will be followed by Mr. Leonard Black. Nyanda, only on delays of investigations. The rest we will deal with later. Mam Gwenya?
Thank you, Chairperson. Hopefully we will come again for other questions, because this presentation to me got a lot of questions. I would like to thank first the presentation and also to get the document in time. It gave us enough time to scrutinize them. So I like to thank that. Chairperson, the presentation is raising a lot of questions, but I'll focus on what you said in terms of the delaying of the investigation. Chair, there's a big challenge of this delaying of the investigation. I think now is high time that all of us, we need to make sure that we come up with a mechanism of solving this problem. The delaying of investigation are the one that is causing a lot of overcrowding in correctional service. Now, I wanted to know that what mechanism are you going to do in terms of making sure that there's no delaying of investigation? Because when we go to the oversight chairperson, you'll find that in our centers, inmates are sitting in a waiting trial more than 5 years. And today we get the explanation that the correctional center, whether it's the head of the correctional center or the management, it looks to me that they are not doing their work effectively. Because if they delay to give you the statistics of the inmates that are sitting in the correctional, in a waiting time more than 5 years, it's a problem, because in your presentation, nothing is explaining that. But on our side, we saw it with our eyes. When the inmate gave you the card, you see that this person have long time in a prison. And now my question is that if this person sits in the correctional center more than 5 years without sentencing, what is going to happen when that person is going to sentence? Are these 5 years or 6, 7 years is going to calculate it on his sentence? You'll find that no. That means this person have feeling who has feed this person for 5 years with the budget of correctional service just for nothing. I thank you.
Ms. Colabona.
Thank you very much, Chair. This would be about the increasing juniorization within the detective services. I'm from the Police Portfolio Committee, and certainly there is a SAPS commitment to increase the numbers of detectives, but it's not enough. It's the training, and we certainly recently had confirmation in the Portfolio Committee that it's a problem, that we have... Well, we discovered, and we're most disconcerted to discover that so very many of the so-called detectives had in fact had no training at all. So I would ask, certainly we're putting the pressure on from our portfolio side, but from the CJS review side, I think that pressure must be equally put to bear and kept up until such time as one feels it is infuriating to sit and hear from a judge last week in this same meeting, hear him say that in fact he has to throw out good evidence because a detective who'd been in the position for a matter of weeks had literally raped a crime scene. The fingerprints were wrecked, the evidence, very good evidence, had to be thrown out. And we can't let the criminals go free for lack of training. So please, that would be my request to this board. Thank you.
Thank you so much, ma'am. Baban Zobu.
Well, thank you, Chairperson. What impact has happened to the additional 2,153 new recruits in the directive? That's the first question. The second question, what will happen to the magistrate? Because it seems if from 83 to 93, only 10 people that we're talking about. Are we talking about the whole country or what? The last question is the... I don't see Chairperson the statistics about the child family and child protection sexual offense unit. If that can be provided, maybe it will help us to understand exactly where we are. Thank you very much.
Cindy?
Thank you, Chairperson, and let me also welcome the presentation. In the presentation per se, there is nothing that is saying anything about the new bill on fingerprints as to how, as a cluster, you're going to ensure that that bill works, for instance. That bill is about obtaining fingerprints from the Department of Home Affairs, from the Department of Transport Correctional Service, and which we think it should assist us in finding criminals, if, of course, they are South African. And there's nothing that talks to that from the cluster. And what is interested to know as to how have you prepared for the implementation of that bill as a cluster. As maybe Ms. Kolapana has indicated, we were told by SAP that about 4,000 detectives are not trained. And you're not telling us as to how you're going to deal with this backlog, because I don't understand as to how the 2,153 new recruits undergoing basic training are going to assist in detective services, because the curriculum that they are following right now, it doesn't include that. It doesn't prepare them to do detective. It prepares them to be police and police. For now, you qualify, and then after that you undergo the 2 weeks detective training and then the 6 week trade detective training. It is only the new curriculum that will be introduced next year that will address this basic training for detectives. And I don't understand as to how this figure is going to assist in the detective services, either than in police or visibility of police. I don't understand as how this is going to assist us. And maybe the last one. You are saying family violence, child protection, sexual offences were also reintroduced to ensure effective. How is it going to do ensure effectiveness, and how is it going to contribute in reducing overcrowding if these are put in place? Indeed, we appreciate that. Let me say from the point of view of the portfolio committee, but how are these going to assist in reducing overcrowding? And lastly, Chairperson, I'm not very sure that this would be relevant to detectives, but the bail, for instance, one is interested to know as to whether you have systems in place to monitor the granting of bail. Because I fully agree with these things that I hear, the conditions under which bail is granted. But I will, as an ordinary citizen and not a law or a legal guru, fail to understand as to how can a person be granted bail 42 times. How can a person who is involved in cash heist be granted bail 14 times and go out to do the same thing again? How can it be possible that this can happen? And if it does happen, do you have systems in place to monitor the granting of bail, that it is not abused by our magistrates in court? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mack.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, you know, when I went on my way here, I was approached by one of the staff members of Parliament asking me for advice that last night or the night before last night, they stole a whole gate at the house. They went to the police station. The police said, no, we are not interested because there's no suspect. So I don't know whether the police expected them to arrest the person because there's a suspect.
The point I would like to make is, and I'm not the one to crack the police, whatever the case is. What we need in the South African Police Service is a change of a mindset. And I'm going to explain why I'm saying it. I've been there. The principal thing which needs to be brought back to police investigations is back to basic things. Back to basic in investigations. You know, it is a very serious concern if you see supervisors. We are talking about 2,153 recruits who doesn't have a clue what is the A, B or C section of a docket. The supervisor is of serious concern. And I would like to know from the police present here whether they still got the 24-hour inspection, to court and back from court inspections. And not to abdicate that responsibility to the case flow management team to do their work on their behalf. Because that is the basic managerial and control which needs to be done in any investigation, in any detective branch, that proper input and guidance should be given in the diaries. So that is a serious concern to me. I would like to know whether it is the case. My experience recently is that your commanders and senior police officers responsible of managing these projects don't really know what a docket entails, what is the docket all about. So we can pump in, but if there's no guidance, it will be fruitless. Then we had a system in the police where, when a young guy come from college, we had a uniform investigation team which investigated less serious crimes like assault common, assault GBH, capable homicide accidents and so forth to gain detective experience. And then from that pool, people were recruited to the detectives. Because I was one of those commanders, check those and make the necessary recommendations that this person is right for a further course in detectives and you feed your detective pool from this experienced guy. They know and they got on the job training how to take statements in the charge office and whatever the case will be, or nowadays we call it the community service center. So, it is a serious concern just to deploy 2,153, although they mentioned in the report there will be hands-on supervision like field training within the detectives. But that takes time. But in the meantime, there's a lot of dockets to attend to. But for now, for starters, because Chairperson, the speedy finalization of your cases serves as a deterrent outside. And if that is not been done, then crime is going to just continue as it is. But for now, I will stop there. Thanks.
Thank you, sir. Mamnanda.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thanks for the presentation. My concern is that the records of previous convention produced within 30 days, fingerprints are forwarded to the Criminal Record Center for processing for within 72 hours. Why is the investigation taking so long? Because here, it's 30 days, it's 72 hours, but in the investigation it takes so long and the sentencing takes 2 to 3 years. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Meneer Abraham.
Baie dankie, voorzitter. Chairperson, regarding speedy investigations, I'm astounded that the other day there was the location of the body of a Mr. Gambella. And within days of the body having been discovered, someone was charged. The case was apparently heard, and a conviction took place, all in one day. Everything happened in one day. Yes, according to the press, and I hope that the papers don't lie. But in any case, and it's a murder case, So, Chairperson, I would love to know if that was possible in that particular case.
Well, we can't see a replication of that.
That we can save time, money, human power, everything. If we could be given an explanation, Chair. Then, Chair, with regard to the slide where you talk of the 2153 new recruits, you talk of the forensic services where significant exposures were identified, that it has received specific focus. Now, if you've given them increased capacity and additional funding, what are the results now? Is that division functional? Because you still read in the papers about cases where blood tests were not taken for investigation, whatever. So how functional is it? We can push in the resources. Have we got the human power to see that the job is done? If you could explain that. The Family Violence and Child Protection and Sexual Offences Unit. There too, Chair, 1 year every now and then of something that they had missed out in the investigation. Now again, Chair, the issue is, Chairperson, to me, a lot of what I see in this light is like a wish list. Very simple to say that we shall be doing this and that and the other. I would love to know, what did thou do? What are the results? I mean, when were these strategies implemented? And since its implementation, what is the degree of improvement that we can see? And then, Chair, if I may just handle up this one, Chair. You see, we have judges that visit the correctional centers. And what I would like to know is, do we have prosecutors visiting these centers to see what are the conditions under which detainees are detained in these detention centers? I think if they can do that, they will come to other more humane conclusions. Finally, Chair, Mr. Durant mentioned, and this is vital in their turnaround strategy, that the information system faces challenges within the justice cluster. Now, if we could explain, when he says the information system, is it the system between the various sectors that make up the cluster that faces the challenge? I may just say that a significant amount of money is made available to the DCS under the budget allocation for administration, and especially the programs on information technology. Does Mr. Durant now say that the fact that this is a challenge means that we are not getting value for money in terms of the IT systems in which we are pumping in so many resources? If you could perhaps give us your take on these things. Thank you, Chair.
Yes, ma'am.
Chair, actually, I think this might be appropriate under this particular section. It's also about the FCS units. I'm very interested in the claim in the presentation. That after that initial Sanford decision, well, Jackie Salebi's decision to scrap those units, that they've now had a number reintroduced because the questions to the Minister of Police don't quite tally with what you're saying. which is 176 units established at cluster level in all 9 provinces. So I'm very interested. Are they in the process of being re-established, or are they established? Are they fully functional? And have the members of SAPS who were so experienced in the previous units before they were scattered to the wind, have they now been reconstituted, incorporating that expertise? Because so many of them have this expertise, they could actually deal with a raped 3-year-old and get information out of the child. It's a highly, highly specialized field. So I'll be very, very interested to hear that information. Thank you.
Thank you very much, ma'am. Just 2-3 more from our side, and then we're going to give you not more than 10 minutes or 15 minutes to respond. We're talking about speedy investigations. What is the prevalence, or how do you deal with situations where the investigating officer go to court, you get there and the investigating officer is not in court because he was granted annual leave? Cliptown Police Station last month. Now, person was charged or arrested in August. 2 weeks ago, Cliptown Police Station, the magistrate throws it out because the investigating officer was granted leave. That's Cliptown Police Station now. So, and I think I'm taking what Mr. Abrams is saying. You can't come here and give us wish list or theory. We work on the ground as MPs. We'll give you the practicals at the police station that we want you to. And I'm sure if it happens at one police station, it happens all over. So investigating officers go on leave and the case must be thrown out because he's on leave. The second thing that I'd want to raise, also in terms of delays, you know, Sophia Town Police Station, you go there today, half of the drug lords in Westbury, unknown to everybody. Everybody knows where the drug lords stay, which corner they sell from, all those good things. People go and report to Sophia Town Police Station, nothing happens because the police are on the payroll of the drug lords. We'll give you those names and numbers if you need them as well. This is what is delaying the investigation part of it. What are you doing about it? Case in point, Sophia Town. Half of the drug lords in Westbury are the paymasters of your people. In fact, when I get arrested, somebody will phone and say, look, Vincent is arrested there, and somebody will release him from Sophia Town because the drug lord phoned and said, Lord, I'm Malik, also out here. The final thing that I'd want you to raise on this matter around investigations, again, a practical example, Florida Police Station, you know, we in Johannesburg. The investigating officer can't get hold of him because he says to you that after 5 o'clock, I'm not phone. I don't have a phone after 5 o'clock. I'm not going to use my cell phone because the police don't give me cell phones. So in other words, if he's not in the office, even if I have lead to where they must find the stolen goods, you can't get hold of the guy that's doing the investigation because either he's not in the police station doing something else, or alternatively, he's at home and he doesn't have a cell phone. So investigating work comes to a standstill. And I would assume that would apply to cars. So in terms of resourcing these detectives, what is being done? Now, I've given you 3 cases and 3 police stations. If need be, we'll give you the specifics around which investigating officer, which date, who's the people in charge. But these are the things that are happening across the country. When you respond to us, please help us with those things, because these are the things that hamper investigations, or at least the speedy resolutions of investigations. The final one, and I suppose it's a general one, you know, your investigating officers abuse their powers terribly sometimes. Terribly abuse their powers as investigating officers. And I shudder to think how do the people out there handle it when people like us, members of parliament, struggle to get out of it. So, is there the training that you're talking of, is part of that training explaining to them that in fact they are servants of the people and not the ones that abuse power? Because again, many people in the constituency where I come from rather take the law into their own hands, because if I take it to Inspector so-and-so, he's going to abuse me. So it's Pietra von Diamond van Selten and Hanum Klamakalistra. This is how they talk in the community. So those are the type of things that I'm asking the investigator or the detective unit to comment on, so that we get a sense that things are moving. Thank you very much. Anybody from the detective?
Thank you very much, Chair. If I can ask General Mulu to perhaps deal from police aside with the questions that have been posed to him.
Thank you, Chair, honourable members. Regarding the delays in investigation, people in custody for more than 5 years awaiting trial. We've got a process with DCS where we receive a list of the people that are awaiting trial, and on a continuous basis, we focus on these specific cases to establish what is the delay. And my colleagues from DCS will bear to this that in all the cases that were provided to us, we were able to establish the delays and take rectification. Where there were problems regarding outstanding DNA, we fast-track those DNA. We pick up problems at times where the IOs do not inform the forensic science laboratory that these cases are on the court roll. And that's why it does not get priority. So we implemented a system at the forensic science laboratory where the prosecutors now request prioritization of DNA reports. And if there is delays, these things are sent to us as well from the investigators, where then we intervene at national level. We also went further. In 2008, when we looked at one of the issues was the awaiting trial detainees, where they were, the CJS as a whole, there was a complaint of 25,974 cases that were outstanding, where people were in custody, that the investigations were outstanding. Because at that time we were unable to confirm or deny these complaints, we decided to go and physically look at these dockets. And of these dockets that were perused in all nine provinces, we have established during that survey that 62.12% of those cases were trial ready. And we've supplied those lists to the NPA and to correctional services to inform them with the case numbers that these cases are trial ready and they can proceed with the trial. Unfortunately, we did not get all the cases. We saw over 60% of these cases. Other cases, when we were at the provinces, were either in court, so they did not bring it for the time that we were there. We did this survey over a period of 3 months during October and December. So these things are continuously being done where we request lists from correctional services on specifically on awaiting trial detainees to try and reduce the people that are, the citizens that are in custody awaiting trial, so that we'll not keep them there unnecessarily. The problem is, with increasing capacity, it comes with other dynamics. We fought for a long time that we do not have enough capacity. And management took a decision that 30% of all new recruits will go to the detectives. But one of the short sights of that was, we did not at the same time ensure that we would be able to train these 30%. And we have to admit, training is not something that you can do overnight. At that time, we were able to ensure that the training division prioritized the training of detectives, but the maximum that they could train in a year was 1,200 at that time. That's only focusing on detective training. But then, other divisions within the police, as well as their priorities, for training, like crime intelligence, your FCS, and this year, they are only able to train 800 of these recruits. So what we've decided is, for these new recruits, we designed a specific 2-week intervention, but that 2-week intervention is basic investigative work. It is not something that will equip a detective to investigate a murder case. So a directive was sent out that these new recruits will only get your less serious cases, like your assault, your theft, and will not be given cases of a more serious nature. The 4,000 plus that we still need to be trained, that is out there. What I want to add is, in the new curriculum of the training of police officials, the 2 weeks has been introduced. So that the new recruits will get the 2 weeks, but the ones that are already out still need to go through this process. A directive was sent out to the provincial training managers to do these trainings locally within the provinces. The detective learning program is a 14-week program, which is only presented in Borland and in Hammanskraal, the Detective and Crime Intelligence Academy in Hammanskraal. So it is one of the challenges, how are we going to get this backlog of 4,000 trained? As I've mentioned, only 800 will go through the basic detective learning program in this financial year.
Master, before you move on, I want to refer you to your slide. You see, on your slide you have a page that says challenges, and you've got challenges. Then you've got a next page that says steps that have been taken to implement. And you very boldly say that you've increased it by 22%, you've got 2,153 new. Now, if we hadn't asked this question, South Africa out there would sleep easy tonight because these are the things that are happening. And yet you come here and you say you can't even train 1,000 a month. That's what you're saying to us. That is on the new recruit, never mind the backlog. You can't even train 1,000 rand a month. So why put this first bullet point in there? That sends a message that things are happening in terms of detectives. Now, we've raised this many times. That when you send these slides out to this portfolio committee and to the public out here, you better make sure that when you come and present it to us, at least we are happy with it. I, from where I'm sitting now, and from what you've just said to me now, am of the opinion that this bullet does not belong here. In fact, it's more of a challenge than what you've done. I don't want to say that somebody is misleading us or somebody is trying to fool us. What I'm saying is, when you bring documents to us in future, you better be able to substantiate what you're putting here to this committee, because this is no longer a step that is being implemented. It's a challenge if you can only do 800 people. So as you go along with all these questions that you've raised here, if you don't have an answer, rather say to us, I don't have an answer. But don't talk to us just for the sake of talking to us, because the next time we ask this type of a question, then there's going to be consequences for it. But we can't accept this as a portfolio committee. We cannot accept this type of thing as a portfolio. I just thought, let me raise that across the board for everybody else. You can continue, sir.
Thank you, Chair.
On this point. Yes, sir.
Chair, if you turn the page that you are quoting, the second paragraph, it says, target intervention are then conducted at identified stations to ensure that the investigation of outstanding court cases are still in the final line. What does that mean in the view of what they tell us now?
I didn't follow that. On the next page you have?
Tended page that you were quoting on.
Yes.
And then the second paragraph, and then you read the second line. Targeted intervention are then conducted. Then you read all that line. It exactly says what you are asking, sir. What are we talking about?
if what they're saying is true.
All right. I think Mr. Ndlovu has emphasized that. When you say one thing to us, across the board it better be consistent. Because we read these things. I said it last week, I'm saying it again today. We read your stuff. We go out into the field and we are not going to be misled or going to be spoken to or are going to be oblivious of what is happening out there. So as you go along, there's about 15 questions that you need to answer, sir, that came out of questions from the members. Please ensure that if you do not have a proper answer, it's rather you say just something in writing than to respond to us. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, the 2,153 new recruits, the impact it will have is the 2,153 new recruits will have a basic two-week investigation course when they come out. So they will be able to investigate your less serious cases. They will still have to undergo a 14-week detective learning program to investigate your more serious cases. So the impact that it will have for the detective or for the CJS as a whole is that your less serious cases will be ready for finalization. And it won't, hopefully it will improve on the awaiting trials on those less serious cases.
Just to clarify that, I think what General Munu is saying that those 2,153 recruits have received some basic training, but thereafter they will still have to do full detective training. And I think that is what the question is. When will that take place, etc.?
You're opening up a lot of words here now. You know, I'll get those members to repeat. Let me just explain. No. I'm telling you, you're opening up a lot of problems. You see, you're saying these are for basic. If you go to it, we're talking about a waiting trial here. My question would be, what number of those awaiting trial are basic and what number are not basic? Because if the larger number are not basic, then what you're saying to us has no impact at all. There's no dispute on that. And when we go to correctional services, they say to us their major problem is that the nature of people that have been detained and arrested are for serious crimes. So the police has got people that can do basic. The country has a problem because people in a waiting trial are for vicious and serious crimes. You're not doing anything, sir. You are not doing anything. And I think this is the protest that members are having. Let's take Cindy and saw another hand up front here, just on this matter here, because we must get these things clear before we, otherwise it's a talk shop. Cindy, and then Mum Gwen, on this matter.
Yeah. No, thank you, Chairperson. I think the answer is really confusing. My understanding, Chairperson, is that the police have developed a new curriculum. It will be a 1 year theory and 1 year practical, or 10 months practical and 2 months back to college to integrate the two. So it will be a 2 year program. Our understanding from police is that will be introduced next year. And because the duration of training for police has been increased to 2 years from 1 year, so many of the courses will then be introduced, including the basic detective training. It will form part of that curriculum, if my understanding is correct. But that will be introduced next year. Now we're talking, according to this year, it is talking to people who are undergoing basic training this year, following the current curriculum. The curriculum, which is 1 year, 6 months theory and 4 months practical. That my understanding was that. Now, that curriculum, which is this year's curriculum, does not include, as far as I know, the 2 weeks basic detective training. It is after you have completed it in terms of training. Now, I don't understand. That is why we're asking as to how these people, who when they complete, will be ordinary constables, like any other constable, who afterwards will need to undergo the 2 weeks or whatever weeks basic training or whatever number of weeks basic training. That is my question. Otherwise, what he is actually saying is that we are wrong, or the police are wrong, to tell us that they have trained constables or police
who are 4,000 and are working without the training for detectives. They are there. They are detectives, but they have not been trained. They are trained as SAPS members, but not as detectives, because the curriculum that is existing now does not include, it doesn't make them to be detectives. And that is my question. Because if what he is saying here is then correct, then as the portfolio committee, we have the wrong information from SAPS. That is the problem. Because that is what we understand, that the new curriculum will only be introduced next year. And that is the curriculum that has this basic training on detectives. Now, we cannot be talking about people who are on training right now, because as far as we all know, they said they are following the current curriculum, which does not include the basic detective training. And that is why we are asking as the portfolio committee or members of SAP to say, how are these people? Are you saying you are going to take people who have not been, who do not have any detective skills to do detective work? And how is it going to assist in speeding up the investigation of cases? Because there are people who are there, who have been serving as police for quite some time, but they still cannot do this function. They are there in detectives, and we are worried that the portfolio committee, that they are not trained. And that is the question you are asking, and that is why I can't understand as to how this 2,153 can assist in investigating cases. I thank you.
I'm going here.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, the answer is not the way I was expecting. And I feel that, Chairperson, they must come back and give us a clear answer and the time frame, because in terms of the challenges and how are they going to address these challenges doesn't give us a time frame that on such a time such a delaying of cases we are sure that is going to happen. And I don't get any sense in terms of those people who are living more than 7 years in the center, that what are the plans that they've done in terms of that. But what I get more is that they don't get more information. They don't get any response from the correctional center. And it shows that, Chairperson, they never even one day go to our correctional center and see the mess that is there in terms of this backlog of the detainees. Thank you.
Chair, just a point of information, I think, from you. I think this sort of input is just invaluable. But I am concerned that there's no one here from the Ministry of Health in relation to their forensic laboratory, because I think much of the backlog situation actually sits at their door, because the blood samples are taken to those laboratories. They sit there. We know full well in many metros, no one is ever convicted of drunk driving, because it takes well over a year for someone to go with a forked stick to the laboratory. It's still there 18 months later, and they will not keep it on the court roll for over a year because of the backlog on the court roll. So I would have thought they would supply some invaluable input to this gathering.
Thank you very much. I'm sure Cindy's noting that. We will, even if it's in writing, get some sort of response. Let me just refresh you, sir. Time is up. I think around the generalization and the training of detectives, we would need more detail later on. Let's not be bogged down with that. But there were issues around the child protection units, fingerprints, monitoring of bail, to court, back from court, the case where everything happened in one day, the forensic functionality thereof or those units, prosecutors visiting centers, the IT systems, are we getting value for money, and the status of the specialized units, and a few more. So let's stay clear of the training and the generalization now. We've got a sense. But if you could deal with all the others for us before we move on.
Thanks, Chair. If I can ask General Mulu just continue on those, some of those aspects, and then we'll deal with it.
Thank you, Chair. Honourable members, on on the case of the inspection, a directive has been issued regarding the different levels of inspection that to be conducted. And during our inspection, during the inspection from national, we focus on these inspections. One of the things that we issued in our directive is that we do not want to see inspection by commanders stating that continue, comply, proceed, continue, expedite, scene. We said that in those inspections, there must be detailed guidance given to the investigators. Because what we found is the commanders would write continue and then the investigators would not know what to continue with. So our directive is that you would give detailed instructions. And we prepared a manual on, or a directive on exactly what is to be done on 24 hours to port your monthly inspection so that the commanders are aware of it. We also designed a detective commanders learning program, just focusing on the commanders themselves, so that their functions is spelled out as to what is required of them when they do inspections. The question on the gate, the honourable member spoke about, that actually, if somebody reports something to the police, it is the police job to investigate and not for the police job to tell them that because there is no suspect, they cannot open it. And that shouldn't be accepted. If these things come to our attention, then we would take steps on them. We need to react to these things. Because everybody, it is not the member's job to decide whether to investigate or not. So it shouldn't be accepted. The investigation branch that was previously functioning in the police, we decided that all the investigations should be under one division. And what we did is, we introduced four categories of four sections at the station. We said that your new members should start in the Detective Service Center. They formerly called it the Crime Office. We changed the name from a Crime Office to a Detective Service Center because your crime should be reported at your Crime Service Center or Community Service Center or Charge Office as it was known. And then the Detective Service Center is where your detectives should give immediate attention to the case. One of the issues that we found was that, as mentioned, that in one of the questions was, your crime scenes were not properly done, and that's where you lose your cases. So we designed a step-by-step guide dealing with the different crime scenes, what is expected at different crime scenes. This was already done, and we are in the process of designing a step-by-step investigation guide for these crimes, which we will finalize, but it is part of the target set for the finalization by this financial year, the end of the financial year. So that if an investigator goes out to a scene, he has a step-by-step guide. If he goes to a murder, he should know who he should call out at the murder, what is to be done at the murder scene, and that's what we introduced for the investigators out there. The client service or the detective service center is there to cut out the problems on crime scenes not done properly. And at the same time, to form a basis of recruiting detectives, because your new recruits will start at the Detective Service Center, where they will work, as you know, only after 2 years they are fully fledged members, and then only they can go out, or they become members of the SAPS. They are on probation for 2 years. So that they will do the probation in the Detective Service Center to be able to gain the experience, and if they prove to have investigative experience, then we can recruit them for investigations. The speedy finalization of the case in question, I'm not aware of the details of the case. I would be speculating if I give reasons. One of the reasons could be is that when an accused maybe pleads guilty on the arrest and there is a plea bargain, then the case can be finalized speedily. But on the specific case, I'm not aware. I would have to check that, Chairperson. The increase in the forensic capacity, those increases that were given, it will take a minimum of 2 years before these people can be trained. So they are, and also in the same vein, they also have a problem with, their trainers are people from within the forensic science services. So that during the time they are training, until these people are trained, you would have, again, most probably a backlog in your analysis. The situation on investigators on leave, the National Commissioner as well issued a directive that not only would vacation leave, but with all, whether it's to do with training, whether a member is gone on a course or on vacation leave, sick leave, that 3 days, if a member is off for more than 3 days, the dockets of those members must be allocated to another investigating officer that is present. And during our inspections, we focus on these things as well. Chairperson, on Sophia Town and Westbury, to do with the drug information, information that comes through via crime stop call centers, I can talk for those information that we receive because those things are locked and we open a file on those and we follow it up with the station that we give the information to. On information that goes to a station directly from the community, I would not be able to specify on those. But because the crime stop call centers fall within my directive, those things are logged onto the system and followed up until it's either negative or positive. So that I can talk for. I do not have the statistics with me, but it's available of the amount of information we receive daily on those issues. Resources, cell phones, vehicles. It was a problem that detectives were not issued with cell phones previously. But there is a process in each financial year, and it's still not enough. We said the idea is that every police, every detective should have a cell phone and a laptop to do his or her work. But at this stage, we started with the commanders and the different groupings so that each group and the people on call will have a cell phone. I have the figures, but not with me, of the amount of on the resources when it comes to vehicles, cell phones, your radios in the vehicles. We do a quarterly, I do a quarterly audit on resources, and then we send those things out to the provinces to see if they can't increase where there is shortages. There is places where there isn't any. So during our inspections, we highlight those things and we give directives to the provinces to assist with those things. I agree, we do not have enough. The idea is everybody should have one. We were this week busy with a meeting as well where the deputy, general from Air Office said that every detective, that the PC should ensure that every detective starts getting a laptop to be able to do his or her work. The abuse of power, yes, these things are reported, there is steps taken. But unfortunately, there is people that do not want to get involved. I agree, people are afraid to come to the police to report these things. So you'll find somebody phoning from another. I have personal experiences where you'll find people phoning from KZN, phoning to head office, saying that they don't want somebody from that specific place attending to it. And then we direct people from my office to go out and intervene and obtain the statement, and then we ask the province to give those investigations to somebody from provincial level to investigate. But you will still have them, and we would like to get these things so that we can take remedial steps. If we do not root out these things, it will continue happening. So those that come to our attention, we've set a lot of traps where people also are involved with activities that are not legal. I'm talking about people within the service, and we arrested a lot of them. I will ask the Brigadier to answer on the FCS unit.
Then, Chairperson and honourable members of the Parliament, I will have my input on the reintroduction of the FCS, which stands for Family Violence, Child Protection and Sexual Offences. By June this year, these units were established. Prior to restructuring, we had 66 units in the whole country. By June this year, we established 176 units, which are aligned at the cluster level, reporting directly to the provincial head of detectives. Currently, we have already placed 1,997 members countrywide. We are in the process of building these units. By the announcement of our Honourable Minister of Police earlier this year, that these units should be fully operational by the 31st of March 2011. We are in that process. Coming to the effectiveness of this unit and what difference will it make in the police, this is a specialized environment. They are specializing in the intervening skills of children and also of abused victims of sexual related crimes. We fully believe that in order to make a good case in court, you need to obtain a fully detailed statement in terms of the events that transpired on the commission of the crime. We believe that by having our members directly intervene the victims of sexual offences, we'll have an impact in terms of reducing the secondary trauma in a case where the statement is not fully taken and that the IO, who is now handling the docket, have to go back and re-obtain a statement, which sometimes comes from the prosecuting authority where they instruct for a retake of statement. By directly having our members working directly with the victims, also will also help to build confidence in order to deal with one person from the beginning of the case until the end. These are issues which we previously identified earlier, where we had short statements taken in charge of it by an experienced member, and later on the real IO has to go back to retake a statement. So we believe that by having these statements taken by specialized members with specialized skills will also help us to prepare a court-ready docket when the case is presented in court.
Sorry, Chief. Continue.
No, Chairperson, you know, one was expecting an answer that will talk to the role of the cluster. Because right now we're talking about SAPS and the role of SAPS as an entity, but I think here we have the cluster. These apps are re-established for a purpose, to speed up the processing of these cases. You do that, but what happens in the court? If we go to any court right now, if we were to attend this house and go to the next court here, are we going to see any difference in the processing of these cases? I just wanted an answer that does not speak only to SAP, but talking to the role of the whole cluster in this regard.
Before you respond, Ms. Kolabana, and just before you continue, Ms. Kolabana, remember, our objective here is to deal with the overcrowding and so on that affects everybody. So we really don't have the specifics around the SAPs or correctional services, but how do these impact in the value chain right around, Ms. Kolabana?
Okay, I think if we can just mention, we're well aware of what the unit used to do and that the SAP scrapped them and trying to reestablish them. You know, we knew what their value was before you scrapped them. So now that is being and the question was, do you have the specialists in there who already existed? Have they been incorporated so we can speed this up and move the process along? I think that was the question.
Thanks, Jefferson. In the re-establishment of this unit, the old members of the SPS unit were invited to re-establish the unit. By having them, that will help us to have a court-ready docket by the quality of statements and dockets produced in court.
No, thank you very much. I'm not sure which of you must talk to it, but there's, I want to remind you again, there's the issue about the people getting bail multiple times. How does that happen? Is the IT system, and maybe not just the IT system, the entire database, we consistently hear that investigating officers go to correctional services can't give them that information, and that hinders their progress. The IT system is a value for money, because correctional services, I know, spends a lot of money on these things. And if you're spending a lot of money and it's not helping in the process, and let's start something else. So somebody must answer those questions. And then, do prosecutors and other role players go and visit? We know that the judges and magistrates, or maybe at least the judges go. But do prosecutors and other people go and see what's happening downstream so that they understand the implications or the urgency of what they need to do? And then there was a question around the new bill on fingerprinting. Could answer those four questions and we move on.
Thank you, Chief. I can just deal with some of those and I'll ask some of my colleagues to deal with the others. I think first and foremost, if we deal with the IT system aspects, I want to indicate that we have challenges across the cluster. It's not just one department, it's across the cluster. So what we're trying to do is we've established an IJS board which deals with the ITs across the various departments to ensure that they deal with the things in an aligned fashion and try to integrate things. That's a long-term thing. It's not going to happen overnight, but we are very thankful that a lot of progress is being made. In this regard, we've already got a portal that is established that gives the input from the various departments possible so that the systems can link and talk to each other. So that's already in place. But however, one of the major challenges that we have is in two specific departments, that's in correctional services and in SAP, where we have a lot of upgrading to do in terms of their current IT infrastructure. The Minister of Correctional Services, for example, recently indicated that that is one of her big concerns, is that their IT system is not giving even her what they actually need. And as a result of that, a lot of work is being dealt with to update and deal with that system. I do not have the specific details as to how far they are, and I think we'll give you a written response in terms of that. But I can indicate that we are monitoring what's happening there, and we're putting a lot of pressure in terms of that to help deal with it. Also from the police side, they've got a lot of police stations countrywide. which need to be upgraded, etc., from older systems, etc. And that's also receiving attention, and good progress is being made. But I think what we try to convey in our presentation is that one of the basic things that if we want to deal with overcrowding is to get accurate statistics and the profiles of various people that are there for a long period of time. And I think that is what they are now trying to focus on, to make sure that their system gives us that integrity of data so that one can deal with it properly. We can go to the prosecutors and say, well, these are the cases. Now deal with these cases so that we can take them back to court and make sure they are prioritized. That is something that, I think they put on their priority list from DCS's side. And as you've indicated, a lot of money is being pumped into that to help deal with it. So hopefully we'll get some good results from that side. In terms of the question of a prosecutor's role, I'll ask that Kurt Smith to just deal with that, but I can just indicate that we are now taking prosecutors to visit prisons, and we've taken several of them to visit some of the very overcrowded prisons to look at that specifically and make sure that they then also be part of the solution, not from the other side. In terms of the fingerprinting bill, from our side, what we've dealt with is to help deal with an implementation plan for dealing with that once Parliament has passed it, etc. Even before that, we started to engage with the role players, police, Home Affairs, the other role players, to make sure that, the systems can talk to each other, start dealing with that. So a lot of that work has been dealt with to make sure that the implementation can be dealt with in a proper way. And I think at this point in time, without even a lot of additional funding, etc., most of that can be dealt with as we speak. So I think that has been a very good exercise where a lot of integration has happened. In terms of the one slide, slide 11, that talked about the number of prosecutors, 83, legal aid, 93, and then we said more judges and magistrates have been appointed. I think the question was, from 83 to 93 is not much magistrates, but I think they perhaps misread the input in terms of that from the slide. We said that the prosecutors' numbers were increased by 83, legal aid by 93, and then we said there were also more judges, etc. That number wasn't given because we didn't get it by the time that we had the information for the presentation. We will give you that number of judges and magistrates specifically. Chair, I think we've noted the concern from your members in terms of some of the aspects. We will be taking back to the JCTS class the specific aspects relating to, for example, the training of detectives, which is an issue, not only for you but also for the cluster as a whole, to make sure that that is dealt with properly. The continued focus on equipment in particular, the cell phone aspects, etc. Then specifically regarding the IT interventions across the cluster, to keep on with that focus as a cluster. And then in terms of the aspect that you mentioned relating to Sophia Town, etc., all those come down to basically one thing, and that's corruption. So the JCPS cluster has basically, as one of its outcomes, the specific attention on corruption. And I think what we will do from our side is, we will get a number from the detective services where any issue that relates to something that might smell of corruption like this, indicate you know the drug laws, you know the names, you know where they are, etc., can be given through to that number so that they can specifically follow up on that, and we can make that widely available so that people can deal with it and focus on it. So I think that's a very valuable input that you've given. In terms of the bail and the other aspects relating to the prosecutors, if I can perhaps ask Advocate Bradley Smith to just deal with that quickly. To deal with the Department of Health aspects. You give some input in terms of that as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We'll also take the liberty of just answering one or two of the other questions which were not answered. One regarding whether the periods awaiting trial are taken into account in the sentence, because obviously that impacts on the sentence population. That is a factor that is taken into account. However, let me emphasize, it's not on a discount basis. You don't get 5 years off your sentence because you've been awaiting trial for 5 years. But it is a factor that is taken into account by the presiding officer or judge in determining what is appropriate sentence in the particular matter. Second of all, let me just say that I do agree with members that the contribution of these new detectives, let me call them detectives in training, is going to be minimal. The older recruitment process, where you actually identified individuals in the force who have demonstrated aptitude and selected them for detective training, obviously they'd have a bigger contribution. But like any tub water, you've got to make sure that there's a trickle in. So where the junior detectives or the new recruits actually start picking up assault matters, obviously more senior detectives can then shift on to the more complicated work. So we do expect that the contribution initially is going to be small, but hopefully it grows over time. And the critical thing is that they mustn't just have, it mustn't result in just more cases being resolved, but it must result in cases being resolved in a short time. Because if you resolve more cases, you're going to have more arrests, your numbers are going to increase, and the only way to keep the numbers constant, as we've managed to do, is to make sure that the cases are resolved in a shorter period of time. That way you keep the average numbers constant, and that is quite critical. Second of all, let me deal with the Gambella case. I don't know the facts of the case, but you would also appreciate that the facts show that Mr. Gambella disappeared a long time ago, so there's been a long period of police investigation until such time as they found the matter. And this was probably a case where the accused was quite cooperative. So one can speed these things up if the accused is willing to plead guilty, is willing to even plead guilty to jail time, as in this particular instance. So that's not impossible to have cases finalised in a very short period of time. And there are interventions. In KwaZulu-Natal in particular, a number of individuals have very early in criminal matters indicated that they've prepared to plead guilty to serious crimes such as murder, rape and robbery. And those matters have been immediately transferred to the High Court where they've finalised the matter by plea and sentenced them. So there are ways to shortcut processes, and it obviously depends on the individual facts of the matter. If the accused is wanting to finalise the case fast, there's no reason why the system cannot fast-track the particular case. Regarding the Department of Health, it is a particular challenge. Fortunately, the blood alcohol issue, which is the forensic laboratory of the Department of Health, only deal with that issue and issue relating to toxicology, which is usually somebody who's died and they've taken a liver sample and so forth. They have huge challenges, both relating to staffing and facilities. Drunk driving cases, very seldom are there people in custody in DCS. So I'm going to be quite brief in saying that what we've done is we've supported the Department of Health. We've gone to Treasury to try and get additional funding, both for their facilities and for additional staff. And where there has been additional funding, they've been able to work down the backlog. So the backlogs are coming down. But once again, if there's a police operation, there's multiple taking of blood or the breath analysis systems that are used by some municipalities are challenged and they're found to be wanting, then the pressure will once again shift. It's a bit like a pendulum. If we can move more cases to be finalised by breath alcohol analysis, the driver systems and some of those which happen at these, then there'll be less pressure on the laboratories. That is a juggling system, but it doesn't affect the overcrowding circumstances very much. The issue regarding to the specialised units, specialisation should bring greater efficiency. You're able to focus, you have people who know how to deal with the cases, know how to get it right the first time. So hopefully that, together with other interventions, integrated individuals, you may have heard of the Tutuzela care centres, the one-stop centres where a victim of rape can go and have the matter dealt with in a very sensitive matter, all the information gathered prevents re-victimisation of the victim. That can speed things up. And also having dedicated sexual offences courts also speeds things up. But obviously there's a challenge. The number of dedicated sexual offences courts, for example, has been on a gradual reduction. The magistrates are resistant to be there because you can imagine if you're dealing with the horrendous sexual offences and rape matters, children, adults, whatever, for a long period of time, that is very demoralising. So it's critical to rotate staff, but you still need some specialised training, specialised skills. You need people that have an empathy and can deal with that matter. Not everybody is designed to deal with those cases. So there is a huge mental pressure and a huge challenge on individuals in such matters. And let me reiterate that, yes, there are people from the NPA that do go and attend correctional services centres. For example, recently I was at Mthatha, I visited Johannesburg on multiple occasions, and Potch. So we do get around, and individuals in the court, fortunately, visit us. One issue regarding multiple bails. Unfortunately, I'm not aware of the fact where somebody got 42 releases on bail or was released 42 times with various offences. But we do have those instances where individuals are released on bail where perhaps they shouldn't be. By the same token, we have people who are not released on bail who perhaps could have been released on bail. Magistrates have to make an objective finding on the particular facts presented in the particular case. And the role of the prosecutor and the police is to make sure that those facts are placed before the court. There are times when in fact we believe the person must be detained in custody and the decision is to grant the individual bail. In those instances, we appeal to try and make sure that those things are set right. So there are instances where the courts perhaps get it wrong, admitted, but hopefully those are in the minimum. And where there are those glaring errors, those matters are taken on appeal, both from the perspective of the accused, legal aid board or private attorney can obviously take the matter on appeal, and a little bit more complex, but the state can also take those matters on appeal. So hopefully we get it right most of the time. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Can we move on to court proceedings? Affordability of bail, and then we'll deal with the awaiting trial and the remand detention centers later. Members can ask questions, anything that is bugging them or they want clarity on around the court proceedings and the affordability of bail. Open it up to members to ask those questions. Let me start while they're thinking. I suppose private lawyers also have a role to play. Something that worries me a lot in my constituency, because I come from a constituency where courts and all those things happen every day. You know, somebody would phone you and say, my son is going to court today and I don't see the lawyer around. 9 o'clock in the morning, I don't see the lawyer around, I'm worried. 2 minutes later, you phone that person and you ask, has the lawyer arrived? I'm talking about a private lawyer. No, he didn't arrive, but he phoned me and he said to me that he phoned the prosecutor, and between him and the prosecutor, they agreed to delay or postpone it. Just picked up the phone. Maybe he's having a bad day at home, or he just picks up the phone, talks to the prosecutor, and between him and the prosecutor, they decide, look, let's postpone it. Now, I'm not sure if there are criteria for postponing. Can anybody just pick up the phone and say, let's postpone this thing? And I know that you must have legal representation, but I do think that there's a lot of abuse, depending on how familiar I am with the prosecutor, being a private lawyer type of thing. So I don't know, just raise that one as one of the glaring things that happens, especially in the smaller magistrates' courts. Again, there's a magistrates' court in Sophia Town or Newlands, I don't know what it's called now, but that one, it happens every Monday. Lawyers just phone from Elders because he can't make it to Sophia Town and the guy must remain or go back to Joburg to Joburg prison because the lawyer didn't come. So that was one of the issues that I thought I would raise around the court proceedings that take place. Members, are you ready now to ask questions on anything around court proceedings? If you're happy with the presentation, you don't have to ask questions for asking questions. Like, let's take Cindy and then take Mr. Abraham.
Yeah, no, Tepetan. Again, my question will be on monitoring. I think it is a norm that courts open late, adjourn, postpone cases or remand cases. It's a norm. It happens. Go to any court today, any court, and don't choose just any court. You'll find this. I don't know. My question is on whether you have means and ways of monitoring. But when these things happen, what are the consequences? Why are they happening over a long period?
and nobody seemed to be sanctioned. Is it possible? The issue about the complainants, when they are to come to court, probably they have to travel, they are paid. And you find that a person has been coming to court and claiming money for transport 4 or 5 times. And the question is, why is this happening? Why is a person called to court, a complainant called to court, when the court knows that the case is not going to be heard? Why is it happening? I can give you a list of people, but you can just go to Mitchell's Plain here and see if these things that you're raising, you're not going to find them. They are there. They are happening every day. I can, let me ask Jefferson the very last question. It's alleged that there might actually be magistrates who are on payroll for drug dealers. You can actually see that by the very fact that a drug dealer will go to this court and it is this magistrate who will be available, whether it is during the day or night, and this drug dealer will get a bail. Is it possible to identify these things? Because ultimately, it affects the work of the court, but also it exacerbates crime. And we can't therefore. I'm just asking. The issue I am asking for is whether it is possible to monitor and to correct these things. If you go to Elukwatini police station today, in fact, magistrate court today, I can tell you all the cases will be remanded because the court shall have opened at 10 if it is early, but it can actually be something to 11. But at 1 o'clock it's going to adjourn and all cases shall be remanded and people are paid money for traveling from wherever to the court because their complainants are told to come. They have to ask leave from their work and they, I mean, it's just like it has to be like that. Is it supposed to be like that? Is it possible to monitor these things? I'm just asking.
Thank you very much, Mr. Abraham, and followed by Ms. Kolabana.
Baie dankie, voorzitter. Chairperson, I have a couple of questions. In the conclusion, it is stated here that it can be categorically stated that the JCPS cluster is committed to ensuring that all people in South Africa are and feel safe. Now, Chairperson, it is one thing to have such an ideal. What bothers me is that nowhere in the presentations thus far, or let me put it to you this way, Chair, in all the presentations thus far, what we have heard is, yes, we need remand detention centers to be functional, we need to bring down the overcrowding, etc., etc. But nowhere, sir, do we hear that we need to bring together civil society, sociologists, the religious groupings, everybody in the fight to reduce the levels of crime. Mr. Chair, while we are sitting here at the moment, somewhere in our country there is a criminal deed, a despicable one taking place. I mean, last week, Monday in Shongweni, drug addicted people, according to the press, go along and kill an innocent lot of poor people. I mean, they're human beings, they're our children, they're our mothers, they're our sisters. Yesterday, Greenstone shopping center in Invale, according to this morning's news, 15 armed people just walk in and hold everyone up and rob the place. Now, there is a disjuncture in our society. There's something gravely wrong. When you go overseas to certain countries and you read the papers there, you see nothing about crime or precious little about crime. Unless if they are hiding it and they're not publicizing it. But you get into an SAA plane and the first thing you look at in the newspaper turn page, some other major criminal activity. Now, Chairperson, I'm saying this because we can make whatever plans we can, unless we don't change the psyche within our society, we are not going to get things right. And I'll repeat what you have said, Chairperson. As you go to certain parts of our country, with impunity, you can see things happening in front of you. I don't know whether the visible policing is working or not. We can see these things. You can see that somebody who had nothing a year ago in one of the townships is suddenly driving around half a dozen motor cars. The house is no longer a couple of roomed house, it's a double story. I mean, surely these things come from the proceeds of crime, and drugs are key to that. We see these things happening on a daily basis, Chair. You open the paper, you'll see these things. Now, the JCPS cluster can turn around and say, yeah, but you know, we are not sociologists. But Chairperson, I believe that even the investigating officer has to, we say in Afrikaans, he must actually kap van die bail for. You must try and understand. Why did that person commit the crime? Not a question of just arresting somebody because he's committed a crime. So it is that person that is a bother. And what sort of society are we going to get our children and our grandchildren to inherit? I think it's also the responsibility of the JCPS cluster, Chair, to say that this is what we find. And these are the sort of interventions that are required. And we need to work on that, Chairperson. It is, I think to root out crime, Chairperson. Look, you can never root it out totally. But to bring it down significantly is the responsibility of every sector of our society. And we need to work on that, Chair. And I would like to hear more from the JCPS cluster as to what they find needs to be done by other sectors of society in order to see that we move forward. And have these things at least dropped by a significant percentage. At the moment, Chairperson, as we are sitting here, do we feel safe that our families at home are safe? Do we feel safe that our kids who are going to school will come home safely? I mean, you have a 16-year-old kid in Alexandra Township drunk, getting into mummy's motor car, And driving along the street and killing this promising 17-year-old young girl and injuring 2-3 other people who are now finding themselves in hospital. What is wrong with our society? Shouldn't such a parent be penalized for having allowed the keys of the motor car to lie around or something? A motor car it can be a convenient thing, but it can also be a dangerous tool in the hands of the wrong person. So these are the sort of things, Chairperson, that bothers elderly people like me who are on our way out. We would like to see something left behind for our children and grandchildren. But Chairperson, regarding, well, you know, obviously we are young, you know, at 70 we're not kids anymore. sorry, Chair. Chairperson, the other thing that bothers me is that regarding the three remand detention facilities that are being prioritized for upgrading. You say here that the guesstimated cost is over 400 million rand. And it would be subject to option analysis, feasibility studies as required by National Treasury, and whether they should be procured through the PPP route or that it should be design and build or other. I say, Chairperson, that you must be the boss of your farm. It must belong to you. This PPP route might sound an easy way out, but if you take the long-term financial implications, and especially in a security establishment, I cannot see why we should source out facilities like these. It is wrong. I think the principle is wrong. And nobody can convince me as it is cheaper to go a PPP route. Nobody, sir. Because one and one does not become three. It's definitely two. And I cannot be satisfied that we go the PPP route. So when we are looking at this chair, I think our emphasis should be in owning the facility. It should belong to the state, and the state should have the necessary people to run this particular facility. Chairperson, in conclusion, you say here that to combat the situation of people sitting in correctional facilities with unaffordable bail. Now, you say that the applicable provisions of the Criminal Procedure Act is being promoted and that there are positive results. Now, I've seen some figures here, but over and above those figures, what are the positive results? And isn't it possible, Chair, that for argument's sake, a person who is employed and finds that that person is unable to raise bail, shouldn't we look in terms of a guarantee being provided by the employer? Or some other alternative forms? There's almost slim copper what you said. Come up with alternatives. Tell us that these are the possible alternatives that one should look at. Because you work with the sector, and which will actually see to it that the particular person will at least present him or herself to court. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you. We've always derived our wisdom from, we derived our wisdom from the elderly. I had just suggested that we don't talk around remand detention, but Mr. Abrams spoke about it, so let me open it up to everybody else to speak on any subject, because otherwise I'll be defying the elderly. So you can speak on anything now that you want to speak to, but Ms. Kola Barnard will be followed by Mam Nyanda and then Mam Gwenya. On any subject, ma'am, and then Max.
Thank you, Chair. I'm interested in analysis, I'm presuming it's done, about the issue of cases being sent back across the three spheres for further investigation. In other words, there are many instances where a case is determined to be court ready, it goes to court, and in fact it is returned for further investigation. Now that speaks directly to the capacity of the detectives. I'm interested in whether or not this number is increasing or decreasing. One hopes it's decreasing. I fear it may not be. But it certainly, as I said, speaks to the capacity of the detectives and the knock-on effect, of course, is a longer awaiting trial detainee period. Thank you.
Thank you very much, ma'am. Mam Nyanda.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just want to find out from the JCPS. In many instances, people complain about missing documents, but always we are told that we have already computerized the docket, but others are missing in the church office. And my second question, it goes to legal aid. What is the success rate of legal aid cases in criminal trials? How often are the magistrates visiting correctional centers to check the condition in the centers? I'm going back to the third. I don't know, Advocate Duran, you still remember, we went to Krasbop with you, and the complaint there, they were saying when a white man is arrested, the case will sit at night. The magistrate will be called to come and conduct the court. And we had a problem because these other ones, they keep on saying remind, but there are those who are calling, I can say that, to appear in court at 12 at 1. Thirdly, in Bumala, we had a case of our speaker who was shot inside his house. And it took 1 year, it's only this year, two accused are arrested. One is a constable at Kanyamazane police station. Two is a constable at White River police station. It gives us a problem because there was another murder after that, the director. He was murdered inside his house until up to this day. No one is arrested. It's a concern. Police are not honest. It's what we are saying, that do you people vet these people when you employ them? Because that is very important. You might employ a criminal. I complained one day, I had a meeting with a certain commissioner because I saw a suspect sitting in a police van. The driver is a constable, but it's his friend. And this man is a suspect. How do you deal with that one? Thank you, Chairperson.
Mongonye.
Thank you, Chairperson. Maybe a follow-up on what Mamnyanda has said. I have observed when we make a oversight that most of the people that are poor, who are not having names of big profiles, are the ones that their case are taking longer. But if a person have a big profile, that person, his case or she, her case, is going faster, then I want to know why it's like that. Even the community outside, they've got concerns of that. Secondly, Chair, I want to go back to my preparation when I read this annual report. In 2008 annual report of Department of Correctional Service indicated that 10 facilities were earmarked for dedicated remand detention. Now, Chair, this representation talk about 11 facilities. Can we get a clarity on these figures? Also, Chair, which center are those, and what is the reason behind in identifying those centers specially? Chair, I want to finish on my questions because I had to leave to the meeting of the weeds. My second question, in the same annual report, it was further reported that remand detainees will be migrated to these facilities over a period of 3 years, commencing from 2008 and 2009, which means this process was supposed to complete it in this current financial year. What has caused the delay for this project? The last one, Chair, it is concerned that once again this presentation is silent and on addressing the root cause of crime in conjunction with Department of Social Development. I thank you.
Mr. Max, sir.
Chairperson, yes, sir, thank you so much. I would like to focus on a talk, just a proposal discussion on certain things. My focus is much more on the management, the quality of managers, the quality of police officers, supervisors. And what I'm saying is this, you know, when I joined the police those years in apartheid, the standing order was clear. You know, no non-white can get a higher rank than the lieutenant. And I wanted to become a general. Now, I had to prove myself, you know, in those years. Ultimately, 25 years old, I was a lieutenant, and 38 years I was provincial commissioner. So I had to prove myself through all these conditions. Now we sit with a situation where it is much more easier for people to progress. And but you still got those managerial shortcomings. Now, to motivate people, there's incentives like performance bonuses and so forth. But these things have been done, you know, very subjectively. And those really deserve it, don't get it at all times. But I was thinking about a manner in which you can motivate people to do their best, to get rid of this arrogancy, corruption, laziness, and also skill development. You know, when somebody applies for a job, then he or she promised everything. But after 6 months, a year, they will tell you, this is not in my job description. So then they stick to everything. Now the National Commissioners and the Commissioner of Correctional Services and all those other senior positions, they've got 5-year contracts. And where I come from, the HOD, the head of department, 5-year contracts. Some of 3-year contracts. And you can clearly see once people got those contracts, because there's annual performance evaluation, 6 month evaluation system, then they work because they want a renewal of that contract. Now I was thinking, they call it in Afrikaans, because they held their oomblik gekry. Is it not possible that we do away with this permanent job? If you join the police, join correctional service, join NPA, join justice, then you're permanent. Only those on top got 5 years contract. Why can't each and everyone sign a 5-year contract? Then you will see, that is the answer. Let me tell you, Chairperson, that will be the answer to all this laziness in the government. If you sign a 5-year contract, you know I've got 6 months left. People are going to take into consideration my sick leave record, my performance, allegations against me, criminally, departmentally, that all of that will be reconsidered. That linked in with the previous speaker here about performance of people's problems, this arrogancy in the police and wherever. That they, some of them, there's a lot of good officers, lot of good government employees, but there are those who think they do you a favor to do their job. So I think government must seriously consider this thing. That each and everyone signs a 5-year contract. Then he exits or she exits if the record does not, prove that he or she is capable of doing this job. You sit with this rot in this department and they are not performing. So that is actually a proposal which I would like for this cabinet to that we decide and make a proposal. I will also use it in a debate in the future as well.
Thank you very much, sir. Mr. Stella Del Baba Kavu.
Thanks, Mr. Chairperson. This one is directed to the JCPS. On page 8 of your presentation, you are talking of the failure of the accused to appear in court. I just want to find out who is responsible for that and why are they not appearing in court? Because to me, if the accused, I presume, is the fellow charge, the person is in the DCS cell. Is it the DCS that is supposed to take that person to court or the SAPS who is supposed to come and fetch him to court? Another one on the same page is the loss of court record. I think that one, we need to be sure what we are talking about. How are they getting lost? Are they stolen, misplaced, and who is doing that? Who is looking after them? Because it can't be just that they are lost, and then nothing is happening to whoever stole them or who was in charge of those documents that got lost. On the legal aid, they talk of they talk of the police remain reluctant to consider alternatives to arrest and detention. On that one, I want some clarity. Let's assume we've got an alternative of which we are all looking for. Do we have a plan to look after those people that are supposed to come before court? What are the plans? Because some of us cannot go to court if I know that I'll be charged. Do we have any plans to help the system to make sure that they do go to court if we have an alternative? Thanks, sir.
Thank you, sir. Baba Ndlovu.
Chairperson, maybe other speakers who spoke in front of me have touched on this. I just want a definition of loss. If the jacket is lost, what does that mean? Does it mean that I'm free? If the jacket is lost. If in the legal aid document says that it's missing docket or as such, what does it mean? Does it mean that a person is charged is free, or those people are free? What will happen? We're talking about the well advised in other section where they say that it's computerized docket. Now we hear that there is a loss. How can you compare that? We can't talk in two absences. We talk about absence of court staff and so on. What does it mean to a person who has traveled from Nongoma to Durban only to find that the absence of staff is not there? From Nguavuma to Pietermaritzburg and the person is not there. What does that mean? Does it mean that I'm free, or what does it mean to a person who has been charged? Those are the things that we're talking about, the practicality of the issue. Because if we deal with that, those things, maybe I would understand where we are coming from and what we want to achieve. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Thank you very much. In the absence of further hands, we'll hand over to you for responses. Across the board, you'll just be fine.
Thank you very much, Chair, and also for the questions. If I could perhaps just start with the last question in terms of absence of court staff. I think what we try to convey there is there is going to be times when people become ill, for example, magistrates or a prosecutor or even an attorney. In those cases cannot continue on that particular day. It does not, however, mean that person is free, the accused. It just means that case will have to be dealt with on another day. So it leads to a further postponement or a delay in the finalization of a matter. It does not mean that the person accused is free. It is an inconvenience because the witnesses, if they are there or even the accused, they have to come again to the court. So we're trying to prevent that and see that those sort of things happen as little as possible. But sometimes it's not possible. Ill health or whatever can necessitate it. From our side, what we're trying to do is to make sure that there is coordination between the role players. So if we know that the prosecutor is going to take leave, or a magistrate is going to take leave, or even a legal aid attorney is going to take leave, then that must be communicated to the role players so that they can do proper planning and that the court role is set in such a way that there is a minimum of disruption in terms of that. And that's the role of the coordinating structures to deal with that. In terms of what is a lost docket and what does it mean, or a missing docket, I think there's different things that are at play here. On the one hand, you can have from the police side a docket that is not brought to court. And many times it's said that it's a missing docket because they couldn't find it at that point in time. It does not necessarily mean that docket is completely missing or completely destroyed or stolen or whatever. It's just it couldn't be brought to the court at that point in time. So once again, the impact is that there has to be a postponement so that the docket can be traced or it can be reconstructed, etc., so that the case can continue. What it does not mean is that the person, the accused, can go free. He's not free. If a case cannot continue just because the docket's not there, it does not mean that accused is now suddenly free and whatever. What normally happens is, in all those cases where there has been dockets that have been scanned from a police side, they can recreate that quite easily and they can deal with it. So even the fact that the docket isn't there or it's missing at one point in time does not mean that's forever. They can recreate it and deal with it. From the court side, we also find that at times the charge sheet is missing at that point in time. It might have been misfiled or whatever, so it's just not available immediately, but they can recreate it if required or they can deal with it. So in terms of that, there's not major impact in terms of people going free at the end. It just causes delay. But what we do have that is a major challenge at the moment for us is in certain courts where there has been court recordings that have been corrupted by the system itself, one way or the other, and that leads to delays in terms of trying to get that transcribed records ready and making sure that they are then ready for appeals, reviews, or for cases to be dealt with. So we've got a big action to help deal with that, making sure that those court records are dealt with and transcribed in a proper way. If we look at the question in terms of the accused not appearing at court, there might be a variety of reasons why the accused is not at court. It might be that that person is ill. It might be that he's delayed in terms of transport or something. And that means that when the case is called and the accused has to be there, he's not there. Once again, it does not mean that he is free. If necessary, and if accused was warned to be called or he was given bail, then a warrant of arrest is issued. So we've got lots of warrants of arrest that are issued for accused. At some point in time last year, with the statistics were that we had about 30,000 of them countrywide that are issued on a monthly basis. So the question is that if accused do not come to court, there is a remedy, and the remedy is warrants of arrest. But once again, it has an impact that that case is delayed until the accused can be traced or brought back to court and then dealt with. In terms of the aspect relating to the root causes of crime, Chair, I think from our side we were given a very specific mandate to speak here in terms of certain things, the investigation, etc. The root causes of crime is a very specific issue, and it will require, I think, a whole session just to deal with that and what's happening on the. So we did not cover that in our presentation specifically because of the fact that we were very specifically given instructions or directives from a committee to say this is the focus area. But I want to indicate that from our side, from a crime prevention security cluster side, we are extremely concerned about the root causes of crime and social crime prevention. And that's why in terms of a delivery agreement that was signed by all the JCPS ministers, including the Justice Minister, in terms of Output 1, which deals with the general reduction of crime, there's a very specific focus area and activities relating to social crime prevention. There's also a very specific element dealing to the point that Mr. Abrams made relating to community participation and partnerships and making sure that we bring in those role players, making sure that we have community safety forum where all those role players can be part and parcel of making sure that we deal with that. So, Chair, whilst we've not covered it specifically in our presentation, I can assure you it is a focus area from the JCPS cluster side. In terms of the questions relating to the alleged drug dealers that might be on the payroll, the staff of the court might be on the payroll of drug dealers, I really want to say that I think it might be possible. I can't deny it. We don't have that evidence before us. But what we've done from our side is, in terms of a delivery agreement that we signed with the President, we said we will be focusing specifically in terms of corruption, in terms of two elements. One, general corruption in certain aspects, but then very specifically on all those aspects relating to the cluster departments in the JCPS. So if there's corruption that are suspected from anybody, whether it's a policeman, a prosecutor, a magistrate, whatever, those are the things that we'll be monitoring. So we're putting in place systems to help monitor that, and if anybody can give us information on that, we will be very, very thankful for that, so that one can investigate it and deal with it, because we really want to ensure that our system is the integrity of it is above any suspicion. In terms of the question relating to the remand detention centres, I'll ask Correctional Services to deal with it. Regarding the aspects pertaining to the lawyers and the postponement of cases, I'll ask Legal Aid to deal with. In terms of the Gaskop issue that was mentioned specifically, I want to indicate, yes, unfortunately we still have challenges with transformation, but we are dealing with that. The chief magistrate for Mpumalanga, Mr. Ngubeni, has investigated that, and they're trying to take steps to deal with those matters, to make sure that that sort of thing doesn't happen. So it is an ongoing thing that we're trying to deal with, and we will still have challenges, but hopefully we will over time manage those things and help deal with it through our aspects. In terms of vetting of police and things, that is a very specific focus area as part of the anti-corruption drive and the delivery activities that we have to look at the vetting of all role players and ensure that proper vetting is being dealt with. Chair, I think I've dealt with most of the aspects. The one aspect is in terms of the courts opening late, adjourning, and the norms, etc. I want to indicate that this has been a challenge for us. It's been a challenge because the judiciary is independent. We cannot, from justice's side, make specific norms that impact on them. And the judiciary is the ones that are dealing as presiding officers with directing the flow of a case in terms of the postponements and those sort of things and starting and ending of the cases, etc., in terms of court time. So what we've done is we've asked the Chief Justice to help deal with setting of standards and norms so that we have certainty in terms of that, so that one can deal with that in a certain way, etc., so that they, from their side, can help monitor that and deal with it. So hopefully over time we will get an improved situation there. From our side, I think that has been one of the aspects that we've been fighting for a long time, to make sure that our courts start on time, that all role players are ready to deal with it, and that they have as productive a day in court as possible. So we've been monitoring court hours, we've been monitoring those sort of things. In the Western Cape, for example, I can indicate, and in most other regional districts as well, the regional court presidents have started to, if the court is sitting less than 3 hours a day, that magistrate has to give reasons to the regional court president, what's happening there, what was the issues, etc. So we're finding that the attitude is changing. They are starting to be monitored by their own people from the judiciary side. They're starting to look at it and starting to say, but let's improve on this, let's deal with these things. Here, if I could perhaps ask my colleagues to just deal with some of that.
Thanks, Chair. I think just firstly then in dealing with the issue of the legal practitioner and specifically the private practitioner arriving, obviously that's a question of ethical or unethical conduct on behalf of that practitioner not arriving at court, specifically where there was a trial sit down. It's difficult to say, it might be a case of double booking, that they have a case in one court and a case in another court, they arrange and say, look, I'm unavailable and can we postpone the case. It could also be that it would have been just for a the case would have been for postponement for further investigation, waiting for blood results. There can be certain circumstances where you could arrange a postponement telephonically with the prosecution and with the consent of the presiding officer. But obviously the client's got to be informed about it. But to fail to appear at a court when there's a matter for trial is unethical conduct, can be reported to the Law Society for a private practitioner. For us, from a legal aid perspective, We run what we call a practitioner for court model. So a practitioner is allocated to a specific court, and they must be there, and that must be their station. And that's why we do it, so that we don't have our practitioners trying to run and manage two or three different courts, because then it becomes an unmanageable situation trying to have practitioners having to move between courts to deal with cases. So we prefer a model whereby we have a practitioner there, although at some stages we will rotate them for the exact reasons that they mentioned. Some of the courts, they deal with serious crimes, and that's sometimes you want to rotate them out because you don't want to keep them exposed at all times to some of the cases and the cases that they have to defend. But so we allocate it on that basis, that we know exactly on which day which court is being served by which practitioner from our perspective. If they are not there from us, that's obviously for us a disciplinary issue, and that's something that we can deal with, apart from also being unethical, and they can also be reported to the Law Society, because all our practitioners are members of the Law Society, and any unethical conduct, they can be disciplined by the Law Society. And so that's also for us a critical element. We can't have the same in terms of our advocates because of the way the bar is constituted in being a voluntary association. And we are engaging with them to be able to allow our advocates to become members of the GCB. But that's where the legal practice board
becomes critical for us overall in terms of the regulation of the profession overall, and how do you regulate some of the advocates who can be totally independent and there's no one that then exercises effective disciplinary control over them. When they are in our employ, we can obviously do that. In terms of force remanding cases at will, it's very difficult to deal with the specific circumstances. As I said, in my slide presentation, there are various factors that can impact and could result in then the postponement of the case. And I think that's what Mr. Durant alluded to. So in terms of the postponement, you go and have a look at it. Specifically when you have multiple accused as well, it makes the case a lot more complicated because you'll find at different stages different accused would have a different problem. And then the result in multiple postponements. Some of the accused can be out on bail, the other accused are awaiting are in detention, they get impacted on by that, and so it can complicate cases. And that's what I found. You find most of your cases that are running longer also have multiple accused in it, and that there can be very multiple reasons then as to why the case gets postponed from time to time. So any postponement, though, has to be approved by the magistrate. So it's a judicial function. It's not there for the having in terms of whether the prosecution seeks a postponement or the defence seeks a postponement. It's not them that determine it. It's ultimately the court that must exercise that function and that discretion. And that's where we say, and I think it's been said a lot of times, presiding officers must take control of their courts and their court roles. And that people understand, the practitioners understand it. A postponement is not there just for the having, for the sake of it. And I think that becomes a critical issue in the management of the court roles and the ongoing process in ensuring speedy trial. Just having a look to see any further ones that I could specifically respond to. In terms of unaffordable bail, obviously the results in terms of unaffordable bail is obviously you've got clients that have been granted bail, as I mentioned, then are being held in custody when they shouldn't be, and then holding up resources. I think it is critical, and that's why we say the two-stage approach, and that's why our practitioners have specifically been trained on it. It doesn't need to result in monetary bail, and that's the thing we've got to move away from. As was mentioned, I think, by one of the members of the committee, is that you've got to look at alternatives. Can there not be a bond from the employer? The employer says, I'm prepared to make sure that this person will come back and stand their trial. Those alternatives are available now. That's why the Act was changed, to bring that two-stage to the bail approach, that it doesn't necessarily always have to be in money. It can be that you're saying, I'm giving you bail, but you've got to report to the police station twice a week so that I know that you're still here and that you're going to report. So that also then becomes the situation in terms of unaffordable bail shouldn't be there specifically, and that's what the legal representative should be doing, is putting it there, that my client can't afford the bail. And our practitioners are trained to say, make sure that they follow the two-stage approach, say, my client can't afford to pay bail. These are the circumstances. And then to give alternatives to the court in terms of what can be done. But ultimately, it is the court's decision as to what bail conditions they do impose and whether they do impose a monetary amount. So once again, it's a judicial function. Prosecution wise, they don't have the control. We can put the facts and the information before the court, but ultimately, it is the court that makes the decision. If there is a mistake, yes, we can take it on appeal, and that's what we have done, where we felt that the failure to implement monetary bail for one of our clients resulted in an unfair situation that someone was being unnecessarily held. We then took it on appeal to set that principle, that you can't just say, well, I have to set it only in money because otherwise the person's not going to come back. You've got to look at other practical ways of doing that. I think that's critical. In terms of the question relating to success rates in legal aid time, I don't have success rates in terms of, we don't measure in terms of success rates.
I was going to raise that one. I think the more pertinent question is the perception that people have. Of course, there's no success rates because as long as the case is free and fair type of thing. However, I think the concern is the perception that the legal aid board, if engaged, chances of me being found guilty are greater. Now, of course, it's not just your one, but there is a real perception out there that I'd rather go without any legal advice than to go to the legal aid board because they are embedded in government. That's what happens out there. What is your marketing strategy that says that, look, you're not embedded in government, so to say, but that you will offer fair or at least a comparative legal assistance? I think that's the question.
Yeah, I think the response to that is multifaceted. I think what we've got to understand is all our practitioners are members, and mostly we have attorneys, are members of the relevant law societies. So if any of the practitioners had to involve in a situation where they're involved in unethical conduct, where they're not giving the client the best legal representation, where they are forcing the client to plead guilty, where even they're saying that they're colluding with the state to then make sure that the client is found guilty, that's unethical conduct. And they stand to lose their profession because overall the legal profession has control over our practitioners in addition to us as an employer. And they can be struck from the role as legal practitioners and will never be able to then practice. So they're in exactly the same position as if a private practitioner had to go and do it. I think there have been perceptions that have come over a period of time which have been justified that we have as a remnants of what used to be from a legal aid perspective, where clients said, I don't get paid enough to do this case, so either you plead guilty or we go. So yes, there is some of that remnants that you have to address via perceptions. I think we've changed the way we operate, and a lot of our employers come from the communities that they serve as well. And I've always said, and we always say to our practitioners, you come from those communities. You've got to show the communities how you act and the way you behave and the way you take on their case. And I think that becomes important overall. But obviously from a marketing perspective, and that we've also got to understand why is that psyche still there. And that's why we do the surveys in the prisons for both awaiting trial and sentenced prisoners that didn't want to make use of our service to understand why. And why does that perception continue? I think in terms of the issues that we force clients to plead guilty, that would be unethical. You can and have to, as a legal practitioner, put the options to the client and say, here's the docket, I've gone through the docket, here's the statement, I've consulted with you, these are the issues, these are the hard questions that you've got to answer. You've got to understand the advantages and disadvantages. We can go to trial and put the state to the proof of their case, but ultimately on the facts you may be found guilty, and that you're entitled to as a client. But you may decide to also then plead guilty, but then we can also deal on the sentencing issue in terms of mitigation, how you've dealt with the case. And you have to put that to the client. But ultimately, it's the client's decision as to how they want you to proceed in terms of whether they want to plead guilty or not guilty. We always had, and I've had a lot of complaints from the prosecution saying, your practitioners do not want to plead guilty. And the simple answer is, well, it's, we act on clients' instructions. We cannot force clients to plead guilty if they don't want to, and that would be unethical. I think the other issue, it comes also into the plea bargaining arena. Why don't you do more plea bargains? Ultimately, you've got to convince the client that that is a better route to go. If a client doesn't want to do it, you can't force them to do so. So I think we've got to understand from our perspective, there might be these perceptions, but our practitioners, if they had engaged in it, for us would be a disciplinary issue. It would be a breach of our own ethical code as an employer. It would be a breach of their professional code in terms of employees to do that. But I think it's a process of changing perceptions.
Thank you, sir. Anybody else that wants to? We'll go down the line. Okay, we'll start. Can we start with the NPA? Because we'll end with you, sir. Sit around. NPA, and we go all the way down.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to touch on one or two things which have been left unanswered, let me first apologize to all the witnesses that have come to court unnecessarily. In an ideal world, it wouldn't happen. You'd come to court, they'd hear your testimony, you'd be excused, and that would be the end of the matter. But the reality is that as much as we try to get it right, there are lots of unforeseen circumstances which can happen. The ideal would be one perhaps appears twice. Three times or anything beyond that, I would think is inappropriate. There may be circumstances in a particular case which warrant that, but there should on each occasion be given an explanation to the witness why your matter is not proceeding. Unfortunately, it costs so much to have a magistrate waiting, you can't put just one case on the court roll, and the practice is you have what I would call fallback cases. So if the matter that you set down for trial, the matter that's been on the roll the longest or the accused is in custody, and that falls through, then you've got something else to keep the court busy with. So somewhere we've got to strike the balance and obviously work towards getting it right the first time. If the matter will proceed on that particular day, that nobody will be ill. But the truth is, I think we get it wrong most of the time. So let me apologize to all the witnesses that have had to come to court unnecessarily. Second aspect, and it touches really on two questions regarding getting bail at night. The legislation has been changed. Magistrates may no longer sit court sessions at night. Judges of the High Court may, however, hear bail applications or urgent applications after hours. So the law has been changed. So there should be no bail applications at night, whether in Kwartzkop or in Cape Town. The second aspect regarding whether a magistrate is on the take, so to speak, in the pocket of drug dealers and so forth, that is something which will become clear in the way that he deals with proceedings. If it's one of those grey areas, and obviously you see that the sentences are below what everybody else is imposing for that particular drug offence, or suddenly accused are always pleading guilty in that particular court because the sentences are lighter, then one can obviously appeal. So the criminal procedure system has checks and balances. If, however, it is apparent that it is more serious, then there are various avenues, one of which is obviously the most serious one, is a police trap to catch the magistrate. So there's no reason why any magistrate should be able to get away with things for a long period of time. I think it'll be quite apparent that somebody's on the take. Just regarding the social crime prevention aspects, the JCS cluster works quite closely with the Department of Social Development, and we are on committees and so forth that are dealing with the social crime prevention strategy. It is true that they've got to pick up the brunt of trying to change perceptions, but the JCS cluster has a vital role to play in its deterrent effect, not only from a crime prevention, a policing perspective, visible policing and so forth, but also a resolution, and obviously when a serious sentence is imposed and people may have a second think about committing that particular crime. If they see they're going to get jail time for rhino horns, then perhaps they will take a second look. But obviously, that also weighs up how successful we are, and that's perhaps where we're lacking. If we resolve more crimes, then there will obviously be a disincentive for criminals to commit crime. It's a case of getting things better, getting things right more often than we do. With regard to cases that are sent to the court and marked as court ready, what the police regard as court ready, and they don't have a measurement in their annual reporting, which is going to come to Parliament, of court-ready documents. What they regard as court-ready, and what a prosecutor who has to prosecute the crime, who's got the legal training, regards as court-ready, are not necessarily the same. But if we work hand-in-hand, and the closer we work, the better the investigation will be, the more complete it will be, the better that it will work. So in other words, what we can do is increase the number of dockets which the police mark as court-ready, to the point where that would equal the prosecutor's decision. And that takes a number of years to achieve that. We do have the screening protocol, which is just draft, hasn't yet been approved by the necessary individuals, but it drives towards that particular process of making sure that the investigation is managed, because if you have active management of investigation, you can get a better case and a case quicker to court. The screening protocol is also addressing an issue which was raised, and that is regarding the supervision. It is true. The NPA would not deny that the dockets reflect that the level of supervision has, and the experience in terms of supervision is definitely less. So what happens is, because there's not enough checks and balances on the police side, then the prosecutor picks up a bigger role. But we are a cluster. So we work together in that. So if you have people who have less training, then the prosecutor has to play a more active role. If the investigating officer, and there will be instances when the investigating officer is far more experienced than the prosecutor, then they're able to fill up the gaps even before the prosecutor identifies them. So it is a case of making sure, both from the police perspective and from the prosecuting perspective, that the case is ready to go to trial. We both drive towards the same goal, to making sure that there's justice in a particular matter. Regarding the court records which are lost, may I suggest that it is actually a very minor issue regarding awaiting trial detainees. Most court records that are lost actually are lost between the time of an appeal being noted by a convicted accused who may be in custody but won't be in the waiting trial or detention section. They'll be in the sentence section. Up to this point in time, all people who have had a sentence imposed are no longer considered as a waiting trial detainee. It is an issue because it takes longer for an appeal to be finalised, the record has to be reconstructed and so forth, but it doesn't affect the remand detainee population very much. And I know one of the suggestions, and it may be in the draft Correctional Services Amendment Bill, is to classify them as waiting trial detainees, but there is a huge risk. The moment we move those people who are waiting finalisation of appeal to that category, we're going to start ballooning the one evidence. The case of the scale will be weighted a little bit differently. In terms of making sure that dockets are not lost, the understanding between the police and ourselves is that dockets should be for 3 days before the court hearing. So that reduces the amount of dockets that are in fact lost. And if a docket is lost, that's not the end of the case. Quite simply, if the witnesses are available, they can be consulted, and you can proceed with the matter without having physical statements, because the docket just represents the statements. The only danger is that there was some physical evidence in the docket, which may be missing, and in those circumstances, a decision would have to be made what is appropriate in the particular matter. Whether high-profile cases take a shorter time than cases of those who are poor, I would hope not. There are many cases which are high profile which take an inordinately long period of time. Perhaps the accusers have more money and so they take more preliminary points. But there are also cases which never make the headlines, which are finalised at the first day of appearance in respect of poor accused. They just don't get the media attention that the others do. I would also say, however, that obviously with the more media attention, with the higher focus, there is going to be pressure on the police, on the prosecution, on the courts to finalise the matter more speedily. So undoubtedly there must be some percentage of pressure that is high in those particular cases, and so one would imagine that the natural outcome would be certain percentages of the cases will get greater attention. So perhaps a bit of a concession on that regard. Regarding the 5-year contracts, well, I'm not a labour law expert, but job security, the expectation of renewal, multiple renewals, the retention of staff, those would all have to be factored in that. To my mind, it sounds a bit like parliamentary elected offices. Well, I won't go down that far, too far. The accused failing to appear in court, quite often what has happened in the past is particularly large potential sentence. An accused who has to be in court simply does not answer to their name. That will result in the police transporting, failing to transport that individual. He simply hasn't answered to his name. The police truck has to go so that the court can start at a particular point in time. DCS then have to follow a process of trying to trace the accused and bring him to court. So that has an impact. That trial may be postponed because the accused didn't appear in court at the time or appear in court a little bit later. But there's also a factor where co-accused may be on bail. So a co-accused doesn't appear, the accused is in custody, is in court, the matter doesn't proceed. So all of those have to be put into the pot as reasons why cases don't proceed as quickly as possible. So those just additions to some of the aspects that were raised by members. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
There is. Perhaps can't say there isn't anything. Somebody accused you for being reluctant to consider alternatives to arrest. Legal aid board, your colleagues say that on page. They say, police remain reluctant. Is it true or false? That's the question you're asking.
Chair, thanks. There is guidelines when it comes to when the police should and can arrest. It may happen at times that it is not always adhered to. But we then send out directives when they should arrest and when they shouldn't, when they should. For example, there is a directive that if a person is arrested for being under the influence of liquor, driving while under the influence of liquor, that the case will be the first appearance of the accused will be 60 days from the time of the arrest. The purpose of that is so that the blood alcohol report analysis can be made available. So that it does not go to court and where every 3 weeks the court is obliged to remand the cases. And for your other cases, yes, the police are reluctant because you have complainants that come there. When they report it, they want to see the person arrested because he's a threat at that stage. And if you do not arrest that person, you run the risk of other crimes being committed, because then the community will take the law into their own hands and then retaliate. And we try and avoid these things. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. Moving down the line, anybody else?
Thank you, Chairperson. On the issue of quality of managers, the Division of Detective Services implemented a strategic plan on conducting inspections. On these inspections, we have we're looking at one-on-one sales training to detective commanders, and also one-on-one in terms of the members in the officers in terms of finding the cases that are on hand. By that, we try to coach them. At this moment, we have a program until the end of this year to go to different provinces conducting inspections.
Yes, as we go down, anybody else?
Chairperson, thanks. The issues around the remand detention facilities will be responded to. When the Cabinet has taken the decision to establish a dedicated remand detention management system, that in fact also included then to establish dedicated remand detention facilities. That was the policy framework, was legislation, establish a branch, and the facilities. Now, initially, the department has identified 10 facilities to be upgraded, refurbished, and then be regarded as dedicated remand detention facilities. Now, later on, Minister Balfour has added Mthatha as an additional center, and that brought it then to 11 facilities. The facilities are Porto Admission Center in Cape Town, St. Albans Admission Center in the Eastern Cape. There's two facilities in KwaZulu-Natal, that's Durban Wessel and Pietermaritzburg. In Gauteng, we have Johannesburg, Pretoria, Boksburg and Modderbee. In the Limpopo, Mpumalanga, Northwest area, we have Potchefstroom. And in Free State, we have Gautflay Management Area, the Admission Center. Those and then Mthatha that was added later as the 11th facility. Now, when looking at these facilities, 50% of the remand detainee population was in these facilities. So if you upgrade and you refurbish, in fact, you impact on the lives of 50% of the population in those facilities. Now, also indicated, the idea was to migrate the sentenced offenders out of these facilities to other centers and have only remand detainees in these facilities. With a small population, that's currently the case in 4 facilities, responsible for cleaning the facility as well as nutritional services in that facility to prepare food for the waiting detainees. Now, these 4 facilities, Portsmouth, Durban Wessel, Johannesburg and Pretoria, do have a small number, only between 100 and 200. Now, I'm saying the idea is also to do it with the other facilities. But in terms of the population of these facilities, sometimes it happens that 50% of offenders in the facility is sentenced offenders. And the other 50%, they are remand detainees. So it's sometimes difficult to move some of these facilities if there's no other space being provided around the country. So that process will continue until space or the upgrading process and refurbishment process have been completed. Now, when we requested Public Works as the service provider for exits for the department to procure service providers to upgrade and refurbish these facilities, they appointed consultants to determine the cost for the upgrading of these facilities. And that brought us to an amount of nearly 4 billion to upgrade these facilities. Now, the budget of the department does not allow to spend 4 billion on infrastructure only. What we have then decided is to take 3 of these facilities. That's our Potchefstroom, Johannesburg, as well as Pretoria, to start with 3. Now, the amount for Johannesburg and Pretoria was more than the threshold amount of 300 million. In terms of the Public Financial Management Act, as soon as that amount for facilities become more than 300, you have to go with the feasibility study route to determine what options you have, the viability, affordability, those issues. And we have to follow the Treasury Regulation 16 to procure these facilities. Now, what we have done now, we have handed these facilities over to Public Works and requested them the feasibility study process in terms of the Act and the regulations to be completed. That process has started, the request was made, and maybe very soon a feasibility study project team, that's for external people, will be appointed to finalize then the feasibility and then to upgrade and refurbish these. We are also working in close relation with National Treasury because we have a fixed building program in the department and these facilities must be added to that building program. And top up of money needs to be done. So we are urgently looking at to finalize that process. Now, we are not saying PPP should be the procurement option. There can be other options during the feasibility study that determine what options should be taken. But PPP, this process of Treasury is called a PPP process in terms of that Treasury Regulation 16. But the outcome of the study will determine should we go out on tender, appoint one of these big companies to build and construct or whatever these facilities. That's the process around the PPP. Jefferson, and then the failing of the accused to appear in court. We have since last year introduced a technology system to take a photo as well as a biometric fingerprint of the offenders. Last year, end of March, we have done 17 centers around the country. That process will be rolled out to another 62 facilities in the country so that we have a photo of the accused person. That will make it easier when this person is not answering on his name to identify this person by other means. Now, it's not only 11 centers that's having a waiting trial. There's about 140 correctional facilities with awaiting trials, remand detainees, as well as sentence offenders in the country. So they are being spread also in other facilities around the whole country. But the 11 currently, in terms of population, represent 50% of the population.
Mr. Dam, you know, this remand detention center exercise, you yourself said was introduced in bulk of time. So that's almost 7-8 years ago. Well, we want to know why it is taking so long. And you're now saying to us there's going to be a feasibility study about setting or appointing an investigating team that will go and investigate. That is our question. We can't have a situation, sir, where for 10 years we're talking about remand detention centers. Give us a time frame so that if you don't meet that time frame, you and the minister must answer to Parliament. What are the time frames? When are we going to have a situation where you can take me to a remand detention center that is up and running and around? We are not going to accept another term where there's talks about remand detention center. Right now you're not giving me any satisfaction that we can go back and say to the minister when we meet him, this is the deadline that your department is setting, we'll measure that, we'll measure you against that. We're meeting Public Works on the 24th. If there's a challenge, I want to be able to say to Public Works, this is the deadline, why are you not able to meet that deadline? Because that's why we're having this discussion. So can somebody from Correctional Services, if not today, you're meeting us next week, give it to us in clear time frames. These are the man detention centers. These are the time frames that we expect the feasibility. I'm saying that, sir, because Kimberley Correctional Services, a year later, cost us from 200 million to 800 million rand. It's not going to happen at the remand detention centers. It took an extraordinary long time to do Kimberley. You're now saying to us that you've got to go and do all these feasibilities. We can't sit here and look you in the eye and keep quiet if this is going to be delayed as much as Kimberley's delayed. So my suggestion to the whole cluster is that we want in writing, when are these things going to take place? If there are challenges, what are the challenges? So that as public representatives, we can put the pressure on wherever they are. Because they're necessary. Any other questions that anybody... Okay.
Yeah. Okay, I would say my additional is that since ever the report is indicating 10, can we get a written report that is going to come with what you are saying, I'm adding, in writing, and then I put all this center according to their names, and this one, you have the Mtata, ANZ 11. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Mine, I forgot to raise it. This court in Johannesburg went down last week, Pretoria, and the court recording, how are we going to deal with the, will you deal with that one? Because maybe people now, they will say, we are out, the court has bent down, there's
Sir, you've got 5 minutes to wrap everything up. If there were any, from what I've been monitoring, everything has been answered, but if you want to emphasize, plus the final question is fine.
Chair, thank you very much, and also to all honourable members. We really encourage and really appreciate the robust debates and the questions, because that's the only way that we can also from outside ensure that we focus on the right area, so we really appreciate that. There's two questions that I think we didn't answer sufficiently. The one was from Mr. Abrams, the question of the positive results from the Criminal Procedure Act, what's the impact of that? The impact is basically that 23,000 people that were in correctional services with bail had their cases revisited. And that's substantial. That's why we said there is a positive result. Just to explain that. In terms of Ms. Colabana's question relating to the analysis of cases sent back for further investigation, I do not have the exact figures, but we've been monitoring that trend, and it is a positive trend. There is less cases that have to be sent down. But we will look at that, and we'll come back in writing in terms of that if we have that specific. But we've been seeing that there are three very positive things that has been happening. One, we've been finalizing more cases per year, and that is positive, because that means that those cases that previously had to be postponed, etc., are now finalized. So that is positive. Secondly, there's been less withdrawals of cases. And then thirdly, there has been less cases that had to be sent back for further investigation. So those are three very positive things that we've been trying to work together. Chair, I think we've covered most of the other questions that you have. From our side, we will take back some of the aspects which I've indicated to the clusters, to the DGs, to indicate let's focus more on this, for example, the training, etc., and things like that. Some of the other elements relating to... some of the aspects relating to, for example, that we've indicated relating to the fact that we need to deal with certain things in a more focused area. The ICT interventions that I've mentioned, the fact that corruption remains an issue and that we'll need to look at how to deal with some of those things. So those will take back, and we will continue to make it a focus area from our side. With regard to the last aspect, the disaster of the Pretoria port burning down, we really want to say that that is the last thing we wanted at this point in time, is something like that to happen. But at this point in time, we are investigating and seeing what has happened to the records. It looks like not everything has been burned down. It looks like a substantial part of the records and things have remained unscathed. There might be some water damage on some of the things, but there's also electronic backups and things like that. So hopefully, after we've made a proper assessment, we can perhaps respond to that in an improved way. But I want to say that, from our side, we'll try to see how we deal with it. I can perhaps just indicate that the courts are continuing. We've made arrangements. The building is in two parts, sort of the newer section and the old section. It's the old section which dealt more with the district courts, family violence, those sort of things, civil matters, etc., that were impacted. The other side, the newer side, dealt with all the regional court cases, the serious crimes, etc. No damage was there. So those courts are continuing, their records have not been impacted at all. So the majority of the serious crimes, there's no issue. It's more the civil matters and the district courts that have been impacted. But once again, those courts are continuing as we speak. We've made alternative arrangements, etc. And although it's a disaster, a national disaster, we can't always predict these things that might happen. We're trying to put in place things like off-site storage of data, for example, to make sure that when something like this happens, we still have the records that are available. Chair, thank you very much for it.
Thank you very much. Just to the department in closing, or the department, we understand and accept that this is probably one of the most challenging clusters, because on the one hand, Mascola, Barnard and company want the police to arrest, and the community want the police to arrest. On the other hand, Ms. Ngwenya and company are saying don't detain them. On the other hand, somebody else is saying judges must be seen to be sentencing people harsher. There's always going to be these contradictions. We have to find a way to balance them, all of us. Unfortunately, we have to find a way to balance them. So we will, on a quarterly basis, call this cluster together and deal with whatever the challenges are at the time. But independently, yes, you'll get your own pressure. But quarterly, I think we have to get together where we learn so much from corrections, I mean from police myself, that we didn't know in the past. It was very useful for us. So on a quarterly basis, we will fight with you. But independently, sometimes we're going to phone the police if we think that what you're doing is seriously hampering us. Same with the NPA and the same with the Department of Justice. And you should be able to do the same with us, all of you. If you want our intervention, please feel free to talk to us through Cindy. And then please ask these people to help you to get a data integrity process up and running from correctional services, because I agree with you that the integrity of the data that comes out of correctional services would be dangerous to use anywhere else, because there are probably appeals and all sorts of things. But it's our challenge, all of us. So thank you very much. Also to our colleagues from SAPS, thank you very much. We will continuously invite you, and sometime we'd like you guys, Ms. Kola, Barnard, to invite us also sometimes. Let us come and sit in your committee. But yeah, I think quarterly we'll certainly have a meeting, because I think it's very important. To everybody else from NICRO and Spectrum Judge and the media, hopefully we've all learned something, but we've all got a role to play. The meeting is adjourned. Thank you.